gathered in support or opposition to the arguments taking place today regarding the Affordable Care Act. We are inside the United Methodist building, as I said, next door to the Supreme Court. We have a number of guests coming along today, and we will begin the broadcast this afternoon with a conversation with Jennifer Nandu. She is with the National Council of La Raza. She is Deputy Director of the Health Policy Project there in the Office of Research, Advocacy, and Legislation. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute joy. Tell us, first of all, about the healthcare mission within La Raza.
Absolutely. Well, the National Council of La Raza is the largest national Latino civil rights organization in the United States, but healthcare is integral because we believe in improving life opportunities for Hispanics. We believe that's going to strengthen America, and that Latinos, the future of Latinos is intimately tied to America's future. Part of that is health, and so we have been out there for a decade making sure that the Affordable Care Act and other healthcare reform comes to this country.
You mentioned the fact that healthcare for the Latino community is integral to the future of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one aspect out of the Affordable Care Act that is more critical than others? Is it, for instance, a pre-existing condition or expanded Medicaid access or the healthcare exchanges? Do you get from your membership and from your constituency and clientele, do you get a sense for what matters most?
Well, what I'd say is that everything matters, and but Latinos have by far the most to gain or the most to lose from this the Affordable Care Act, because they are the most uninsured community in this country, and that's usually the thing that comes to the top of people's minds: gaining access to better and more affordable health care coverage, because Latinos are more likely to be in the workforce, but less likely to receive an offer of coverage from their employer. And so that expansion of healthcare coverage is critical. But I'll say, you know, we have co-pays gone. We're getting new young workers insured. For instance, this under 26 provision that everybody's talking about, where young adults under the age of 26 can get on their parents' plans, 736,000 Latinos have benefited from that.
That's a huge number.
Huge number. 1.2 million young adults of color have benefited from that provision. And so there's steps in place already that are benefiting the Latino community, but the best is yet to come.
The stuff that kicks in 2014, that kind of thing?
That's correct. Those expansions of coverage that get to both the vulnerable and those who are just working, trying to make sure that they don't have to have health care expenses overtake their household expenses. This law really benefits everybody across the board.
Has La Raza opined via an amicus brief or anything in this present legislation, or litigation rather?
Yeah, absolutely. We joined the National Health Law Program's brief specifically speaking about the Medicaid parts that expand the Medicaid law, and that's because we felt like much more was at stake with that particular aspect of the law. Now, mind you, there has been no judge that has overturned the pieces that expand the Medicaid program in the law, but the Supreme Court is hearing it. But if it were to be overturned, not only would it mean that we'd lose the provisions of the Affordable Care Act addressing this program, but we'd lose the Medicaid program, which serves more than 50 million Americans, and we might it might infringe upon things like our civil rights, including women's rights, racial and ethnic community rights, etc.
Well, one of the things that I hear from the other, well, it's not like I spent a little, if you walk down the street just a little bit, you can hear them screaming at the top of their lungs, and the teabaggers and the like. They like to talk a lot about liberty and freedom. What value is there within the, what freedom is there in fear? And there are a number of people, for a variety of reasons. You take into account the Alabama law, what's gone down in Georgia, 1070 in Arizona. Fear is something that is a substantial component for the Latino community in the United States right now. I think there's no way of getting around it, because there are a lot of scary people out there who apparently have a particular particularized bias against the Latino community, persons of color. When you're afraid to even get sick, and you're living with those fears already, what does that do to one's life?
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head, which is that there's a lot of people out, you know, outside even these doors, who are fear change in this country, and the Latino community is a part of that change. We're the largest minority community and the fastest growing. But we have to look at that as an investment in our future. We have only been strengthened by diversity, and actually that is the value that I'd like to talk about. You know, instead of fear, it's the foundation of this country to embrace a diverse set of people, bring them in, and make sure that they're integrated. And so, you know, it is true. We have fear in this country because we have laws that are afraid of sort of the changes that are happening in these countries, or reaction to the changes that are happening in this country. But you literally have families who are afraid to go to the doctor because they're afraid of persecution. And we want to change that dynamic.
Within the subset of the generalized community, within the female population in the Latino community, what does all of this mean for them in terms of access, in terms of living their lives more prosperously, more successfully, hopefully more healthily?
Absolutely. And today, on the Supreme Court steps, we were talking about women's health care and access to women's health care. You know, there's a whole set of preventive care benefits for everyone. But because politics got in the way, we had to decide the women's issues differently.
Right.
And President Obama and his administration decided that they would give the full gamut of women's benefits that are important for generally women's health, not just sexual and reproductive health.
Right.
But, you know, things that are just consistent with needing your health on an everyday basis.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the Catholic Church plays a big part in the lives of a lot of the Latino community. Has this created more conflict within the community than, say, the Protestant white folks out there by virtue of the involvement of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and so forth?
Actually, and National Council of La Raza was one of the groups who signed on to asking President Obama not to sign the to expand the Conscience Clause. And the fact is that if you look at all the data, 8 out of 10 Latinos say they're right there saying that Latinas should have good access to the range of options for birth control and to make sure that they can have planned pregnancies. So that's what I would say. That's where I would say that the Latino community is at. I've had, since this whole controversy has come up, I've had people come to me and say, I've been hearing it in my churches, but the fact is that they're not listening. And the fact is that 99% of sexually active women or sexually experienced women use some type of birth control contraception at some time in their lives.
Even within the confines of the church.
That's absolutely correct.
It's a very frustrating thing to deal with.
Well, I don't think this is about people's faith and people's conscience. The fact is, at the end of the day, there is a reality that people face, and the reality is that they need good access to affordable birth control as well as a range of health care services. So many people don't feel that this is in violation of their faith. In fact, they're doing their due diligence and their duty to make sure that they have planned pregnancies, to make sure that they're dealing with the community that they have, that they're taking care of their children. And so it fits in line with very many of the values that they have about respect and family. And so we've not had any challenges speaking about these issues. But what I would say is this. If you get stuck on this issue, you're missing sort of the bigger picture here, which is that there's so many other benefits of this act, even just if you were to take the 72 preventive benefits that are available to everyone who has an insurance plan.
So in essence, what we're talking about is pure diversion.
Absolutely, and we need to get back on track, and what that means is looking at what the Affordable Care Act has in terms of a slate of benefits. As I said, copay's gone. New young adult workers insured. There are consumer protections. You don't have a cap on your lifetime insurance plan anymore. That's for everybody. And the fact is that I've been hearing stories all morning of people who have kids with asthma or children who have faced some serious health conditions who would have capped out at age 5 for some of these lifetime caps. We have to remember that if the Affordable Care Act goes away, those benefits go away.
That's astonishing that can happen at age 5.
Right, and I think you know, there's also no there's no ability to deny a child health insurance anymore because of their pre-existing conditions, and there's just a slate of benefits that have come within the first 2 years of the Affordable Care Act, and this law is a baby. It's brand new.
And to that extent, we can expect it to change over time if it can just survive this scrutiny here.
Absolutely.
It's not done by, well, Social Security was not, when Social Security was passed, it was not the Social Security that we know now. When Medicare was passed, it is not the Medicare that we know now. So we can expect more, hopefully, more humane additions to the law as opposed to subtractions from it if we can just see it survive.
Absolutely, and to your point, Medicare, an over 40-year-old program, it took them until 2006 to get a prescription drug law in place, and it just took improvement over time. We've got to give Affordable Care Act a chance, and I would say that the vast majority of the American public would say this law does not need to go away. What needs to happen is it needs to be improved upon. The National Council of La Raza did not necessarily think this was a perfect law, but we thought it was a good step forward.
You probably would have liked to have seen universal single payer or something closer to it, wouldn't
absolutely.
You?
Health care for all is our goal, and so we'd like to continue in the future making those strides forward, but we have to build on what we have, which is a pretty good start, and something that's already benefited 750,000 young Latino adults, benefited millions of people who have pre-existing health insurance, pre-existing health insurance plan, and many more to come.
Well, let's engage in a little bit of delightful optimism for a moment, assuming that this survives the scrutiny, and I sincerely hope that it does. What is your next step with La Raza?
Well, I'm confident that it has legal standing, and quite frankly, we haven't stopped since the law passed, so we are moving forward as if it is going to move forward, making sure that there's full implementation in the law. But here's what I'll say. The next step is that it moves to the states. And so we have these preliminary benefits in place, but now we have to build the infrastructure to make sure that these marketplaces come into place for people to be able to buy affordable insurance. And so we're out there talking to Latinos across the United States, asking them sort of what are the most important things to them so that we can work with policymakers to make sure that this system works.
What will be, the as far as the states that you're able to move to work effectively in, what are those states?
Well, I think, you know, you've got the early go-getters like California and Washington, but don't be surprised. Even states who say that they're not in support of the law or who are in this lawsuit are making their plans to build their systems. And that gives me an idea that they think this has legal standing, too. So Mississippi is trying to plan an exchange right now or
really?
These insurance marketplaces. And you have all but one state have taken, 49 states have taken steps to make sure that this is implemented in some way, shape, or form. So there's plenty of...
So who's the odd state out?
You know, I can't remember off the top of my head. My mind went blank, but
it's 49
states.
Why does my mind want to think it's Alabama?
Alabama, that might be right.
I say that because I was raised there, and I spent a lot of time referring to Alabama Stan.
Yeah.
Because it has become such a brutal place for the poor, for people of color, for
absolutely
people of Latino descent, and all I can hope is that you all are effective in what you do, because it's going to take a concerted effort by everyone involved in order to make this work going forward.
Yes, absolutely, and I think we all share in the responsibility of this law, but we also all share sort of a destiny together. And, you know, for me, this is about community. It really does take a village, and for so long we've had, you know, systemic issues with our health care. It's
indeed.
Time for a change.
It is indeed. Jennifer Nandu, thank you very much. I'm sorry that the headphones popped out on you, but... I wish you well, and I thank you for your hard work.
Thank you so much.
Have a great afternoon.
Thanks.
Bye now. National Council of La Raza, that's Jennifer Nandu, Deputy Director of the Health Policy Project, Office of Research, Advocacy, and Legislation. And we will be going forward with our next guest in a matter of minutes, Dee Mahan. Is expected to come by, hopefully. Yep. Thank you, Jennifer. Wonderful. Your email's on here, and I will cut it out and send it to you. Wonderful. Thank you. Well, hello, Ms. Mahan. Have a seat. Grab some headphones. We'll point a microphone at you.
One right after another.
And it feels a little crazy at first, but once you get into the swing of things, it's a little bit easier. Dee Mahan is with us. She's Deputy Director of Health Policy at Families USA, our genial host for this amazing in-gathering of progressive voices, and we really appreciate Families USA's efforts in pulling all this together.
Well, we appreciate you being here very much.
It's thrilling. It's exciting. Just before I was going on the air, walking out there, you know, it's nice because our side has the front of the Supreme Court. The right-wingers are trying to get in there and infiltrate a little bit. But we've pretty much got the sidewalk filled up, and that's a great thing.
We have a lot of people out there today. Yeah.
I'd say just for what I saw, there was about 1,000 of us for every teabagger, right-winger, whatever we want to call that bunch. But it's been a tremendous effort with all the people who have been involved. I guess there's Planned Parenthood folks out there today.
Yeah.
How many people were y'all able to pull together for this?
I don't know what the number is going to be at the end of the day, but we worked with a lot of groups, faith-based groups, a lot of different progressive groups. A number of unions are out there. We're really covering the gamut today.
So. I saw some SEIU folks.
Right.
It is indeed an amazing gathering, and everyone, seeing a bunch of progressive people working in common purpose, all marching forward the same way, you don't see that a lot, and it's actually kind of inspiring when
it
you
is
do.
It is very inspiring. It's great. We should do it more often.
Well, we should, yeah, and get better at it and learn to like
yeah.
it, and because, you know, there are those who say that getting progressives to do something together is rather like, herding cats?
Herding cats is the saying, yeah.
Yeah, I've taken it one step further. It's like wrangling butterflies. This is an inspiring piece of work to show that we can stand together in the face of really cranky, loony opposition. For me, Ms. Mahan, I've walked around out there, and I try to have this open mind and, you know, love for everybody. And then I see them, and I don't like them again. And I don't know how this country goes forward with the kind of division that we have. Is there any healing of these wounds, or do we just have to close the bus doors and move on into the 21st century?
Well, I hope that there's an opportunity for some healing. But, you know, you're right. There's an awful lot of divisiveness right now. And hopefully we'll be able to get past this. One of the things that, you know, we're very hopeful for as people learn about what's in the new law and the Affordable Care Act, they actually come around and they don't like it. Even people who start out saying, no, I didn't like it, when they hear about all the provisions and the things that are in there, then they, you know, the needle starts to move a bit.
It's kind of like Brussels sprouts. You don't think you like them, but they turn out to be pretty good.
And, you know, when Medicare passed, there was a lot of opposition to that. And now that's taken us, you know, this is like a program that we can't do without, which is true. But at the outset, there was a tremendous amount of opposition. So as people, I think people sometimes just get scared of change even when it's really good change.
Well, your particular area of expertise is Medicare, prescription drug benefits, the price breaks.
Well, I do a lot
like
of work on Medicaid, too, right
now. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Within those parameters, how do we, because we've seen so many pictures of the Tea Party people with their get your hands off, you know, I don't want any government health care, I'm on Medicare. How do we bridge that? Most of the people who are going to be down here at Capitol Park South are probably recipients of Medicare or Social Security, and yet they don't want it for the rest of us. That's a profound class divide, and I don't know how we get through to them.
Well, it's also, as you said, a lot of people who are on Medicare and recognize that it's an incredibly important program don't realize that it's a government health care program and don't like it when that's pointed out to them. I think that, you know, one of the unfortunate things that's happened is, you know, people go home, they're busy, they don't have time to pay a lot of attention to what's in the news. They turn on Fox News. They turn on news stations that are owned by corporate interests that have an outside agenda, and they listen to that, and what they're hearing are things that are a lot of times, unfortunately, absolute distortions.
Now, you said you've spent a considerable amount of time of late on Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the uninsured, and frankly, when the expansion comes in, I might well be eligible for it. Can we know that it's going to be a significant expansion? What's the actual percentage rate above the poverty rate when the 2014 effects kick in?
It gets a little confusing only because it's 133%.
Okay.
And then you actually get a certain amount of your income disregarded, which is what the Medicaid program does right now. Every month they say, you know, it's a certain amount that you can keep that's not counted. So it ends up being actually 138%.
Okay, and that's a fluid number based on number of people in the household, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. That number depends on how many people are in the house. The percentage is the same, but the income amount depends.
Right.
Goes up as your household size goes up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're talking about around $15,000 for an individual, and then it goes up.
Well, so how many people in 2014 when this takes effect? Out of America's uninsured, especially the uninsured working poor, how many people get added to Medicaid as a result? Or, I mean, that's been estimated somewhere along the way.
It's been estimated. Right now, Medicaid takes care of around close to 60 million people. And one of the estimates on the additional is around 11 million. Now, that's really going to depend on how much states get out there and try to make sure that people know about this opportunity being available.
Well, and that 11 million is already counted within the national numbers of the uninsured,
that's
right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's going to be an $11 million person knockdown of the number of uninsured people in this
that's
country.
That's right. And what we're talking about, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that Medicaid doesn't cover a lot of low-income people. You know, they think that, oh, Medicaid's there.
Well, that's the thing. It's the asset testing. It's the means testing that's present now. I had a guest yesterday, I can't remember which one, that was talking about if you have absolutely no money whatsoever in Florida or Texas, but you are a single individual, you just can't get on Medicaid.
That's right. In more than 40 states, if you are an adult and you don't have any dependent children, so you could have had, you know, 10 kids and they've moved away, you don't qualify.
You're toast.
You're toast, yeah.
And that's a level of brutality that it's hard to fathom that our country is capable of. I'm being given the one-minute wrap-up sign. I've loved this conversation. It's been all too short. Is there anything that you need to get out there that
well,
we haven't talked about?
Just a couple of points. We really encourage people to let everyone that they know that the Affordable Care Act has a lot of good things out there. If people want to learn more about it, they can go to our website, familiesusa.org, or they can go to healthcare.gov, get a lot of information. Please let people know what's out there in the Affordable Care Act and what the new law can do for people.
Dee Mahan, Deputy Director of Health Policy for Families USA, thank you so very
much.
I appreciate you coming by. I really,
really
do.
Appreciate it. Okay, great.
Thank you. And this is the fun part where it's just rolling the guests right through. We are joined now by Joan Alker. She is the co-executive director of and research assistant professor of the Center for Children and Families Health Policy Institute at Georgetown University. Are you Dr. Alker? How's the best
no,
way?
No, you just call me Joan.
Okay,
that'll work.
Great. I'm Bob. I just want to make sure that I don't leave anybody's, because there's a lot of work that goes into this,
yeah.
those titles and degrees. But you are at the Georgetown Center for Children and Families, and you have focused on healthcare access for low-income children and families, and especially Medicaid. And Medicaid, I come from West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
So Medicaid is something that is very, very important to me and to people who are in my region. And I guess there are two ways to approach this. And one is we've got an idea, and it looks like very good things are going to happen with Medicaid if the Affordable Care Act survives its constitutional scrutiny. On the other end of that spectrum, however, what happens if it doesn't?
Well, I think the good news for kids is that we have a very strong set of Medicaid and CHIP programs in place now that have already reduced the number of uninsured kids to 8% last year, which was a historic low. But we're not there for adults, and we need to maintain that strong coverage for kids as well.
Well, what is the difference, for clarity's sake, what is the difference between CHIPs and straight up Medicaid? Where's the cutoff? Where's the dividing line?
It depends on the state, but generally speaking, the CHIP program is covering kids whose incomes are just above the Medicaid eligibility level. But in many states, it's actually the same program, and it's serving kids whose families are earning about $30,000 or less.
Okay, for a family of
three or four.
Okay. Is there a bump in how much does coverage change? Who gets added? What in terms of children, families in fragile situations? Who gets added as the Medicaid provisions kick in 2014?
That's a great question. For kids, we will see some kids who are able to access care through the new insurance exchanges if their families have too much income to qualify for Medicaid or CHIP. But I think a really significant change is that in many states, parents are not eligible for Medicaid today, and West Virginia is one of those states.
Mm-hmm.
They're only eligible at very low-income levels. So you will see, for kids, obviously it's really important to have healthy parents as well. So you'll move to a situation where the whole family has somewhere they can get coverage, and that's going to be critical not only for those kids and parents, but also I think for us as a country to understand that on January 1st, 2014, we're waking up in a country where everybody has somewhere to go to get health care.
And we're not, when we talk about Medicaid, and the other side has been very, very successful at how they have cast people on Medicaid and so forth, but when we're talking about Medicaid, we're not talking about people who are indolently layabout. We're talking about the working poor, aren't we?
Well, really, the primary folks who are getting Medicaid today are children. They're the number one group. People with disabilities and seniors in nursing homes. Those are really the populations who are getting Medicaid services today. So Medicaid is supporting our private insurance system by serving those who the insurance companies don't want because they have too many conditions or that
they're
can't
not
afford.
Profitable. They're not profitably
they're not,
sick.
Exactly. They're not profitable. Or those that simply can't afford the high cost of private insurance.
I think I probably should have rephrased my question a little bit more, little bit better, and that is when on January 1st, 2014, the people who will be covered under Medicaid is going to include a significant portion of the working poor. Is that fair?
That is correct, yes. There will be an expansion of Medicaid so that all adults below a certain income level will be covered.
And there are preventive care aspects to that as well as palliative?
Yes. That's another facet of the Affordable Care Act that I think has not gotten a lot of attention. For kids in particular, there are very important steps forward in accessing preventive care, which is essential to keeping kids healthy. So we just did a report last week that found 54% of America's children has been insured or maintain access to preventive care as a result of the Affordable Care Act, either through Medicaid or because private insurance can no longer charge a copay for your child's wellness visit, that care that's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Okay. I remember reading a good bit about the work that Bernie Sanders had done in terms of rural access, and again, West Virginia being a very rural state. How does the Medicaid access and the expansion of Medicaid access play into the rural healthcare settings?
I mean, I do think certainly rural areas have difficulty with appropriate access to care across the board, not just for folks on Medicaid. We just don't have enough providers in those areas, and I think the Affordable Care Act takes some steps to try to improve connecting providers with underserved areas. Having said that, in general, there was just a report to Congress last week about access in the Medicaid program for kids specifically, and we see that, in general, their access is right on par with those kids with private insurance.
Is this is this expanded coverage, especially for children? Because, you know, when something happens to your child, it's different than when something happens to you. That's your baby, and you tend to respond in a different way. Is this going to change, for instance, the tendency to use an emergency room as a primary care delivery system?
You know, I think what's going to change is that every family is going to wake up January 1st, 2014, and know that there is a way for them to access insurance coverage. So that will change the mindset, the way in which we approach health care in this country. And I'm very optimistic that it will lead to more access to preventive care, developing a medical home so that you have a great relationship with your pediatrician and go to that person first before you turn to the emergency room, which often happens today because parents may be working, they may not have access to insurance, or they may not have access to care during the hours they need the care.
When we all wake up on January the 1st, 2014, What will people, you mentioned that we got a lot of children registered in the last year or so. How will that process work? I mean, is it going to be an outreach thing where we reach out to people and say, listen, you're now eligible for, do you expect pushback in terms of, is it still going to be Medicaid? Is there going to be any stigma attached to it? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yes, I do, and I think there's a lot of work going on already in the states to both get the new exchanges, the new marketplaces up and running, where folks who receive tax credits will be just a private insurance plan. And there hasn't been as much public focus on Medicaid, but there is work going on right now, and we have a lot of systems in place already because so many kids are covered that will be easily be able to outreach to their parents. But there's no question it's a huge change, and with any huge change, there will be glitches.
Is it through like public libraries, the schools? Is it through their employer? You know, I think about Walmart. You know, Walmart had an entire plan or an entire program where they taught their employees how to access the public, what remains of the public safety net.
Mm-hmm.
Getting folks on it seems like that would be a huge challenge.
Yeah.
Because they're not just going to be automatically, we're not just going to run through the data and say, you know, you go get your mail and there's a card in the mail. That's not going to happen, is it?
Right. Well, I think there have been a lot of successful outreach efforts with kids because we've had so much success, and they've been a real community-wide effort, in some cases involving coaches, schools, community health centers, providers, just a whole range of folks have come together to achieve the success we've achieved for kids. And I do think it's hard to underestimate now how much things will change in January 1st, 2014, simply because when you go to the doctor's office now, they will know that there is something that you should be eligible for. There is a way for you to have insurance.
Well, I look forward. I want to see what happens on that day because, among other things, I look forward to getting my own coverage. Even though we've been talking, my children are covered now under CHIPS.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very, very important. And one last thing, where Medicaid is concerned, be it child or adult. That's one of those places where pre-existing condition coverage there won't be any of that involved. Right?
Medicaid already does not discriminate based on pre-existing conditions, so come 2014, the private insurers will not be able to do that either.
What happens? What about the area between Medicaid and private insurance? What's that transition zone?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, for folks whose income is above the Medicaid eligibility levels, many of them will be eligible for tax credits to help them afford purchasing private insurance plans through the exchange. So certainly that will be a key piece in helping to get to universal coverage.
Going down the road is raising the, I don't know whether you call it raising or lowering, but broadening the threshold for Medicaid eligibility, is that one of the means by which we get to true universal single-payer coverage?
Well, it's certainly one of the key mechanisms in the Affordable Care Act to bring down the number of uninsured people. It's estimated about 17 million new folks will be covered through Medicaid.
Is that one of the reasons that the right wing is going so crazy, that they know that this is... That there is a mechanism inside the Affordable Care Act for that?
Well, I think I can just say from the children's perspective that, as I say, as a nation, we've come together, and through government health programs, Medicaid and CHIP, we've had enormous success in reducing the rate of uninsured kids to 8% last year at a time when child poverty had gone up. That was an amazing success, and I think we need to talk about that more, because when we come together, we can solve these problems.
I look forward to us talking about it more, because, frankly, the Medicaid issue is one that I wish there would be more talk about, because I think it's something that people can get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize there have been other elements to talk about up till now, but I hope that dialogue really does get a lot more legs. Joan Alker, thank you very, very much for the time you spent with us. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your expertise on the Medicaid issue simply because, frankly, it means something to me.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for being here and sharing your knowledge across this this outreach. Take care.
Okay. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Are you based in Charleston?
No, I'm actually in Fayette County. It's about 50 miles east of Charleston. We're in a very rural area. And so that's a lot of the things you were describing are realities that we've already known. Right, exactly. And a little bit of off-mic conversation there. I was just telling her a little bit about our experience there in West Virginia and the fun things that happen when insurance companies, for instance, pay for property damage to 136,000-mile pickup trucks and how you get too rich. And hopefully that all goes away. So they were going great guns keeping the guests running in here. We are expecting to hear from Sarah Summer in about a minute's time, and hopefully she will be along. And given the hour, it's kind of a shame that I'm broadcasting in this slot. You know, I could have done 9 to noon or whatever, but. Stand by. No, what I was saying is, given the hour, they are the weirdos will be starting their march real soon. And like I said, I try to feel some degree of sympathy or look at them as my fellow countrymen, and then it all just sort of goes to hell when I see their stupid signs. Okay, but we're back. Since we're sort of doing this on the fly and figuring things out as we go, that sort of thing becomes a bit of a necessity. But we've got someone behind the microphone right now who is reporting from the front lines. Horn intern reporter Ferg is with us.
Hello.
Hi, Ferg.
Hi.
You've been outside. Did you go outside and play with the weirdos?
I went outside and played with the weirdos. At first, I kept my distance because a lot of people were coming through with defund Planned Parenthood, and the Canadian Snapple guy is there.
Have we figured out the Canadian Snapple guy?
I actually went up and asked.
Was it worse than what we thought? Okay. So let's do a little setup on this real quick. Yesterday, I took a photograph. I took a photograph yesterday. I want to get this right because you don't just find this every day.
No, you don't.
Of dude standing in front of the Supreme Court with a sign that reads as follows. Canada. Now, okay, anybody who's ever sat through, say, Logic 101 knows what a syllogism is. And here's what the sign says. Canada has national health care. It has a short growing season and cannot grow much food. At that point, I just felt like not a well man, because it might as well have said, 'twas brillig in the slithy toes, the gyre and gimble in the wave, and all mimsy with the border groves and the mome rats outgraved. Canada has national health care, it has a short growing season, and cannot grow much food. So you talked to short growing season dude. Ferg calls him Snapple dude because his sign sounded like something under a Snapple cap.
It was just a quick trivia fact. Even if you can't learn much from the teabaggers, you still learn something. And
you can call that learning.
I did indeed talk to him, and I don't know really how to word it the way he had, so I'm going to take
whose side was he on? Because that wasn't clear whose side.
He's on the anti-Obamacare side.
Well, of course he is.
I'm going to try and speak a little more. I'm going to try to clarify it for the audience. What he had said to me was, what it means is, since Canada has health care, why should we? He doesn't like Canada. And that.
No, wait.
That's exactly what he said.
No, this is a dude out of South Park. This is like something with Terrence and Philip.
Yes, indeed it was. But what was funny is, I asked him after he told me, I don't like Canada, I like protesting. I asked clearly and calmly and rationally, then what does having to grow crops do with this? And he said, well, I just thought that America needed to know Canada's not all that great. And I was stunned. Yes, Dad, beat your head against the mic. It's after that, I said, well, good day to you, sir. I love Canada. And walked away.
God be with you, eh?
And I also watched them come up from where we had seen them down, you know, Senate Parkway. And they were all coming up. They have their flags flying, you know, they don't tread on me.
Their Gadsden flags.
Yeah, their Gadsden flags. And
I've learned to despise that flag.
And they are all slowly but surely crowding into the...
Well, they're not moving real fast because they're not real young, are they?
You'd be surprised. I saw a few that looked that couldn't...
We saw
a
right-wing teabag attack blonde earlier today.
Yes, but the way I saw it was that there are people there that can't be but a few years older than I. And that means that the apple hadn't
even
fallen.
Though they're not much older than you... They are Atne Ute Aitre, if you one what I eme. Aitre?
Aitre. I'm proud to say that you're my father, even the times that you embarrass me in the supermarkets by dancing and singing, because you've given me something that obviously the right-wing ignoramus parents of those unfortunate adults had. You gave me a logical and rational mind. And for me to go out there and know the truth and be able to think outside the box and at least listen to their own opinions, Snapple Dude, for example.
Snapple Dude.
It's something special because listening to them, they babble.
You know, and that reminds me, I ran across, there was a person in a white lab coat claiming to be a real live, honest to Jesus, no kidding physician. Who was hollering that Obamacare will make PSA tests for men. And there'll be no more PSA tests for your husbands or your brothers. No mammograms for your women folk. And again, claiming to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And I know better. I know better. And I looked at her and said, are you saying that the Affordable Care Act makes... PSA tests, prostate-specific antigens, something you'll learn about when you get older.
No, I already know. I dread the day.
That'll make that illegal? Well, no, it'll make it illegal for your doctor to order it. And I just looked at her and said, yeah, why? Why can't we... Why can't we have... we can have a conversation, but we can't have a debate if you're lying about it. You've got to stop lying, madam, because right now you are a liar. I have read the bill. It's... No. Prostate-specific antigen testing is not made illegal, nor are mammograms. Quit being a liar.
Well,
I just lost all patience.
Well, as Hang on momentarily, folks. We're getting scheduling issues sorted out. I don't...
We're just trying to work out some scheduling details of who we're going to talk to when, and hopefully we're going to talk to Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland here in a couple of minutes. That's what happens during these things, folks. Schedules change, things like that, and what you thought was carved in stone suddenly becomes carved in silly putty. So that's kind of where we are right now. Now, you've got a note in here from Dr. John in New York, Ferg.
Yes.
Subject line, Snapple guy. You are kidding me on that.
No.
Great spot reporting, Ferg. Oh, no, they're
it doesn't take much.
They're out there, and all you have to do is say hello, and they'll start telling you, did you know that Obama's a socialist?
One other great thing to Dr. John is the fact of when I was going through right after Snapple Dude, and... there was a woman that had a sign of abortion, and she said, and it said defund Planned Parenthood. And I asked her, why do you feel we need to defund Planned Parenthood? And she said, because Obamacare is going to take away the birth control and everything, and we don't want that happening. I said, actually, that's the complete opposite. You all are trying to take it away. Obamacare can give it. And, She started ranting on, getting a little upset.
Well, they do.
It's like playing with wasps. You leave them alone, and then when you go and you get near them, they
hop up, son. I think we've got a guest here.
All righty. Well, it was nice talking.
Oh, my pleasure, Ferg. So I'm really tickled here. When I was reading my bios to see who was coming to visit, I saw Spike Ford's name on my list, and I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, cool.
I read your LA Times piece, and was really, really, you know, the line about, you know, I'm a good person,
I'm not a deadbeat.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I'm not a deadbeat, I'm not a loser.
Yeah, I don't drink wine out of a screw-top bottle.
No.
Yeah.
I'm just an average old person.
So, Spike Ward is with us. She is an artist and the creator of the cartoon strip Art. She's a painter, she's an educator, and... I guess the thing that became transformative for you was you also became a cancer victim.
Yeah.
And everything went sideways then,
didn't
it?
Yeah, that was never going to happen to me.
Yeah, bulletproof, right?
Yeah, no, that would never, never happen to me for all kinds of reasons.
I wasn't so above it.
Yeah, I would never get cancer. Yeah, and
then you did.
Yeah, and the treatment for cancer is really creepy, and I'm not really cut out for this, but I got cancer and I'm dealing with it, but... Yeah, we were just living the American dream. My husband and I, both of us, are our own businesses. He's got a real small business. He fixes computers. And I started a nonprofit in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles to get the arts back into schools. And
yay.
Right, yay. And it's a wonderful cause.
I'm such an arts in schools.
Yeah. You know, and we could talk about that on a whole other...
Yeah.
I mean, really, why that's important, but... Right before the recession hit, we were both doing really well with our businesses, and then boom,
just all at once, you know, people. He kept working, and people weren't paying him, and then people quit giving to charity. But I had to keep my nonprofit going. So our insurance was $1,500 a month by then. I know. That's how much our mortgage is in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But because we're entrepreneurs, we had to buy the most expensive insurance on the market, and gives you the least amount of coverage as well. And it was just going up and up and up. And
you know the insurance industry has a very specific word for folks in that position.
What is it?
They're called marks.
Yeah. Thank you. That's right. We're marks for them, and now we're marks for the people that want to say that we're deadbeats because we couldn't afford
right.
it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's like being caught in the crossfire.
It is. And then that's the thing. Reason why I came to Washington, one of the reasons was I want people to know this is the face of the uninsured. You're looking at it.
Me too.
Yeah, okay.
Hi.
Yeah. If the face of
charmed,
the uninsured
sure.
is looks more and more like your next-door neighbor, we're not talking about it. So I wanted to out myself.
We're not Ernest T. Bass.
No, and we're not drug addicts that are, you know, just... Anyway, so we're just the ordinary middle-class L.A. people. We're doing really, really well on our own, and had to use up the retirement and start dipping into our home equity line just to pay for our health insurance.
So what happened?
The bank cut us off. We had $200,000 in our equity line that we were counting on, and we were just going to do that till the recession was over. So we were just going to ride it out.
Ride the storm
yeah.
out.
And then the bank cut us off. So we had nothing. So we didn't have any savings. We burned through my husband's retirement, and now we can't even use the equity in our house. So what do we do?
What did you do?
So we can't do the. We can get through it without having to pay that $1,500 a month with the health insurance. So then we decided, okay, we're going to take this gamble. We'll get back on track as soon as we can.
So you made the choice, food versus insurance, and food won.
Thank you. And there are people out there that actually said we should have gone homeless, that we were irresponsible to choose the house over the insurance. Yeah. There are people that said that. I know. I don't know why people... I don't know what makes people tick.
Well, everybody knows about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it's food, and it's shelter, and mm-hmm. it's water. And, you know, insurance isn't in there.
No.
And it shouldn't be. It should be something, frankly, that we don't have to think about.
Yeah, and writing that op-ed got a lot of worldwide attention. And
as well it should have.
Yeah, and it's countries that have, you know, we're the one developed nation that hasn't gotten this all taken care of. So the other, you know, there's other countries that have had nationalized health care for a while, and it works really well, and they don't want, you know, they defend their health care system.
I got to tell you a story real quick. That was my son who just walked away there, and I sent him out, yea, verily, among the heathen. And there's a guy out there who is anti-Obamacare, and he had this sign. Ferg calls it, my son's name's Ferg, he calls him the Snapple guy because he's got these signs that look like something you would read on the under the lid of the bottle of Snapple. And the one sign he has it, Canada has national health care and it has a short growing season and can't grow much crops. I was unwell when I saw it the first time, so Ferg decides to be boy investigative journalist and goes out and engages the guy in conversation, and he says, why? And the guy responds, well, I don't like this Obamacare, and I don't like Canada either.
Oh, poor guy, really.
But no, you said, you know, industrialized, civilized nations.
Yes.
Or what was the phrase you used that most countries have?
Developed.
Developed, yes.
Yes, we're developed.
Right. Can we make an argument that the reason we haven't so far is that this developed nation has a few undeveloped people?
Undeveloped people and way too many people who make a lot of money off of health care.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of money.
You're in a battle with cancer, and
yeah.
somewhere... There's a guy who has gold chains and chest hair and talks with his teeth clenched
mm-hmm.
and says babe a lot, who's going to get a bonus
because he managed to figure out a way not to pay out for your cancer coverage.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, isn't that the reality?
That's the reality. And were you here for the, did you, well, you've been here all day, so you didn't get to hear the press conference.
No.
But there were seven women, unbelievable stories, personal stories of how the Affordable Care Act is working for them right now. And my story is
literally. And it's working for you.
Yes, my life is being saved because of the Affordable
you
Care
get to be,
Act.
You get to not be dead.
That's it. Bottom line, and or go bankrupt.
Right. I mean, I can't believe I'm sitting here talking like this with someone who is dealing with cancer, but you're dealing with it in a way that's incredibly humane. So, no, go ahead, please. Let me just answer this.
Well,
I see what's going on. Yeah. No, do please. Just take a minute. Take a minute, please, to tell your story.
Okay, well, the story starts in the summertime. I find the lump myself, self-exam, routine exam. At women my age, we do this every month. I find it. I talk myself into it being a symptom of menopause because I don't have insurance. And I find what I'm looking for on the Internet. It tells me I have something having to do with menopause. And then during a routine pap in October, the doctor feels it and says that's got to come out right away, and then boom, it was just it was a nightmare.
And you're at stage?
I'm stage three. So here I have no insurance. You know, you get told you have cancer, you think you're going to die, and it's like someone tells you you're going to die, and then on top of that, the shock of being told that you're going to have cancer, now you have no health insurance. The reality of that, I have two kids.
So was it, did you pick up Medicaid or?
I'm not poor enough. This is the other thing why I'm in Washington. Our tax return from last year shows that my husband made, you know, we, by cashing in our retirement, they don't care where the money comes from. They don't look at that subjectively and say that's too bad. They say you're not poor enough for Medicaid. So there were no services for us. So it was PCIP, pre-existing condition insurance plan, through the Affordable Care Act.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what's saving my life.
Wow.
The Affordable Care Act.
We've got to continue this conversation.
Well, it'd be my pleasure.
No, these things happen way too fast, and the scheduling gets weird. Spike, no, seriously.
It's really nice talking to you.
When I get back into the home studio, we'll have a phone call or something.
Oh, I would love
it. Talk at greater length.
Okay,
I want to hear more of this story.
Yeah, it's a common story.
It is.
It's all too
common.
Yeah, wake up, America.
Indeed.
Okay,
thank you. Spike Ward.
Bye.
Bye now. And the congressman was foreshortened because Representative John Sarbanes is going to drop by and speak with us for a couple of minutes here. Yeah, good to see you again. It's a pleasure. We last chatted in January.
Right.
And it's considerably nicer. Well, yeah, it's nice that it's not pouring down rain on all of this.
Exactly. No snow, no rain.
But obviously, you've continued your advocacy and your support for the Affordable Care Act. You're in the House of Representatives and you're dealing with a lot of crazy people.
Yeah.
What is your sense of? Let's be optimists and say that this is going to survive constitutional muster. Constitutional muster.
Which I think it will.
Are they still going to? Even if the Supreme Court passes on it. Is the majority in the House still going to be jumping up and down and howling and spending a lot of time screaming about Obamacare?
No question. And they'll try, as long as they hold the gavel in the House, they'll use whatever means they have available to them to impede the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And that's why I think it's very important for those who advocate for the reform and believe that it's the right thing for the country to have, you know, to gain good representation in the next Congress so that we can maintain the implementation. Obviously, if the president's reelected, he'll be committed to that, but he needs a Congress that's working with him instead of against him in that effort. And so I'm hopeful that the sequence of events will be the Supreme Court concludes it's constitutional. We have an election in November that reelects the president and also makes sure that the Congress is in a place where it can support the president's efforts to implement this act.
Now, we're going to have a decision on this by June.
Right.
What kind of impact, either way, do you think that that decision will have on the November election?
You know, I think it's hard to predict. It could be it's sort of a wash in terms of the dynamics that it generates. I mean, people tend to think that if it's struck down, that will hurt the Democrats and hurt the president. But it could cut the other way. It could mean that all the people that are worked up against it will sort of lose steam, and those who really wanted to see, and those who really wanted to see this happen will be motivated to get out and vote for the president and for the Democrats who supported the bill. So I think it's really impossible to tell what the political fallout will be. I think as a practical matter, in terms of maintaining momentum with implementation, and of course you have states like Maryland across the country that are trying to get in front of this thing and work well to be in a right position that
in terms of setting it up.
So as a practical matter, the effect of it being found constitutional will help those efforts move forward.
It is, as noted, frustrating for you to be dealing with the Congress, the House, as it is presently constituted. You have to fight a lot of rear guard actions, obviously. What, assuming for a moment that that we can't get the full sea change that we would like to have in the House, how do you go forward defending this act against efforts to water it down, weaken it, defund it? You know,
every day,
the purse strings.
Every day, more people are benefiting from this law.
Sure.
Every day, more young people are choosing to stay on their parents' health insurance and now can do that because of the Affordable Care Act. Every day, there's a family out there who previously was looking at a child that had a pre-existing condition and realizing they couldn't get health insurance coverage, and now they can get it because that prohibition on the conduct of the insurance industry is in place. Every day, seniors who were having to come out of pocket in a sizable way to cover the cost of their prescription drugs are seeing that out-of-pocket expense reduced because of efforts under this bill to close the donut hole. So what's happening is with each passing day, more Americans are benefiting from this reform, even now. And I think over time, that will be the thing that makes this take hold and stay in place. And it'll help us make the argument, the political argument, that this was the right thing to do for the country.
What happens in states, for instance, that have significant Republican majority representation in the House? What happens on January the 1st, 2014, when suddenly they have a lot of constituents who now have, for instance, Medicaid eligibility? That changes the dynamic too, doesn't it?
No question about that. And, of course, there's some states that have been very progressive in getting with the program on this. Maryland is one of them. There are others. And then you have states that have dragged their feet. Essentially, they're saying, we don't want to participate at all. Now, in those instances, HHS, the federal government, has the ability to come in and design health insurance exchanges, as it were, on their behalf. But obviously, it'd be better if they would cooperate. In terms of Medicaid expansion, you're absolutely right. Most states, if not all, are going to choose to accept that expansion because it means a lot to them in terms of resources. And in so doing,
it
they will be...
asks them for no resources in
exactly.
matching funds or
and
anything,
they will be,
it?
And in so doing, they will be participating and joining in the benefits of this act. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy there if they continue to advocate against
that.
It. Yes,
exactly. Well, Congressman Sarbanes, I know you've been very, very busy today, and I want to thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks very
and
much.
And thank you very much for your ongoing advocacy for this act and for all that it means for America's future.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland. All right, we're back, and these conversations, by definition, have to be kind of brief and on the fly. But I was really glad that Congressman Sarbanes could take a minute to have a discussion with us. It's about 15 past one. My next guest has not shown up yet, but let me take just a second here. I'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and I was just noting that the Robin of Locksley, the Duke of Nottingham, Duke Sachmo of Armstrong, whatever. You don't see that on your guest list a lot, but I have Aaron of Montana with me right now, with a real story of the effectiveness of the Affordable Care Act. And Aaron, welcome.
Thank you.
And why are you Aaron of Montana?
I'm not sure. That's how I'm identified on your list. I am from Montana.
Good, good. We've got a very dear friend in Helena.
Okay.
Living on the Front Range. That's how she signs all her emails. Lived on the Front Range.
I'm in the Arctic tundra.
Oh, are you really? the frozen tundra.
Pretty much.
It hasn't been that frozen this year, though.
Oh, it has where I live.
Okay, so you're in serious Montana.
Yeah.
What brings you here today?
Well, I came today to tell my dad's story, Bill Ackley. He suffered through his insurance appeals process prior to the Affordable Care Act. And so he is a good example of problems that can be eliminated through the protections of the Affordable Care Act and their provisions for the appeals process.
And what was that process like?
To give you a little bit of background, he had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and that was managed through chemo for many, many years. And then it came to the point where he was accepted into a bone marrow transplant program. His insurance company paid for all of the preliminary steps leading up to the transplant. They paid for finding a donor, for the chemo to prepare his body for the transplant, and then when his doctor requested approval for the transplant, they denied it.
They said no.
Yes. They stated it was investigational, even though the transplant center had been doing it for years.
Right, yeah. And that's one of those things that the insurance companies love to plead, is that it's an experimental procedure, even though the experimentation ended 30, 40 years before. So they subjected your father to that. And, you know, it's especially cruel when you send the person through all the front-end testing procedures. And where bone marrow transplants are concerned, that's rather extensive, isn't it?
It is. The chemo he had was particularly brutal because they essentially had to wipe out his whole system,
sure,
in order for it to be receptive for the donor cells.
And then you have no immunity from disease at all, right?
Correct.
And so you've got to be extra, extra careful not to be around anything or any germs. How did he deal with it? How did your family deal with it when the insurance company told him to, you know, go away?
We pretty much were shocked, and we were lost at first. We didn't really know where to turn. There's a provision now in the Affordable Care Act where insurance companies have to inform patients of the consumer assistance program in their states now, and that would have been very helpful for us. So we went through the appeals process. The denial was upheld. My dad's doctor submitted a request for a full bone marrow transplant, thinking for sure it would be approved because they'd been doing it for 20 years. That was denied, so we appealed that. Eventually, the denial was overturned, but it took a period of 60 days, and during that time, my dad's cancer came back, and he was forced to go through an additional round of brutal chemo,
which
his insurance paid for.
Well, yeah, penny wise and pound foolish, right?
Right.
So, at some point, do you get to sue these people? I mean, make them pay for their cruelty, their brutality?
Well, we didn't go that route.
Well, I don't know if you could have. So he went back on chemo. Did he go into remission again?
Well, he went through that additional round to keep his body ready for transplant, which he did. And the transplant occurred 126 days after the first request.
I've got to ask you, how did it go?
4.5 months after the transplant, he passed away. And he was 59 years old.
So sorry.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry. So, in essence, your father spent the last part of his life, instead of what I think we would all want, and that is to spend those days in some sort, you know, however it is that the person wants to spend it, but something resembling contemplative reflection, getting things done, getting things taken care of, wrapping up, doing bucket list things, right? Instead, he spent it
in a hospital.
In a hospital, fighting with an insurance company. I hope you'll forgive me when I say that I hope there is an especially hot place in hell for the people who put him through that. I know that makes me sound like a real heathen, but I don't like insurance companies, and you've got reason not to like them. How do you look on this process now?
Well, I am hopeful that patients and their families won't have to go through the agony that we went through. I'm hopeful that insurance companies will be held accountable for their actions and will have to adhere to their time schedules that they say that they're going to give decisions in, and patients will know who they need to turn to for help. Hopefully, you know, this process, it's going to be better for them.
So your father's story stands as a cautionary tale for all of those people who would like to see the Affordable Care Act overturned. In other words, I think it is a direct reflection of the fact that these people don't understand what it is they're talking about wanting to go away. When these people stand out here and chant, hey, hey, ho, ho, Obamacare has got to go, what they're saying is that they want this to happen. They want what happened to your dad to happen to lots more people. Isn't that, I mean, that's basically the essence of it, isn't it?
I'm not sure they're thinking of that.
Oh, well, that's exactly, well, no, thinking is what they're not doing. They're not very good at the thinking thing. But that is, and you, having lived through it with your father, would not wish that on your worst enemy, would you?
Of course I would not. And I have a young child who I want to have, you know, health care and protections as well throughout her life.
Certainly.
So I have a lot invested in this. Everyone does. Everyone needs health care.
Well, you and I, there's a lot of distance between West Virginia and Montana, but there's a lot of similarities in the people. A lot of rural communities, a lot of fiercely independent, you know, pull myself up by my own bootstraps kind of thinking. Have you told your story back at home? And if you have, what kind of responses do you get?
I'm fortunate. I've lived in many different communities in Montana, and I have friends in all those communities, and they're very supportive of me. And a lot of those friends came to my dad's aid by writing letters to our officials and tried to support him in any way they could. So it's the people that I have interactions with as a family, and my community is a great community too.
Wonderful.
I love Montana.
Well, as well you should. And I applaud you for not just tearing at your hair and running through the crowd screaming, because frankly, I probably would in your circumstance. Mm-hmm. You bring real humanity to the story. And I would not blame you one iota if every other word you used to describe that insurance company had been something you can't say on the radio, and our entire conversation was just a syllable and a beep. I would understand. But you don't do that, and you bring real poise and real grace and real humanity to this discussion. And I wish you the best, and I hope you've... have you gotten to talk to a lot of folks here in the Radio Row today?
I have. And, you know, I'm honored to be able to tell my dad's story. I'm sad I have to do it. But I think of how many other stories there are out there in our country that don't get told.
Indeed. Indeed. Erin, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Please go and tell this story to more people. I hope you get to tell some teabaggers, because they need to understand the reality of that for which they pray. So good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. From Montana, that is Erin of Montana, with a cautionary tale for all of us, and especially those who want more. That's what the teabaggers are. They're the more suffering people. And I just can't understand being that. I can't understand in the least. I'm told that my next guest is ready. That would be Elizabeth Widra? Widra. Should have trusted my first impulse. Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's a pleasure. I have to tell you something. They didn't give me a bio for you.
Oh, no.
So my sincere apologies if we just take this from the very ground up and talk about
Sure. What
brings you to Radio Row today.
Exactly.
And the nature of your advocacy.
Okay.
So let's start from there.
Okay, great. My name is Elizabeth Widra. I'm the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which is a think tank, law firm, and action center devoted to fulfilling the progressive promise of our Constitution's text and history.
Yay!
Exactly.
So you're the person I can talk to about the necessary and proper
clause
and the Commerce Clause and the general welfare
clause. Exactly. So
I've been waiting for this conversation all day long.
Excellent. I love people who want to talk about the Constitution.
Well, I do, because it is a living document, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, it's not. I'm sure it's carved in stone somewhere, just like the Ten Commandments. But it has a reality for the 21st century.
Absolutely. You think what the only concern I have with the living document thing is that it makes it seem like there's something that we can't find in the Constitution, that we have to change it. But the brilliance of our Constitution is that it uses words like equality that has expansive meaning. And fortunately, over the 220 years that we've had the Constitution, we the people have amended it to make it more equal,
yes,
to include more people within our democratic society.
Well, we're talking about a document that was drafted at a time when equality was deemed to mean equality for white landed property owners, leaving out, you know, a significant portion of the population generally, because there were more persons of color in the South than there were white folks, and leaving out women altogether. So we have to have that more expansive definition if we're going to consider ourselves 21st century people, don't we?
Right. And fortunately, the text of the Constitution allows for that expansive notion. And so that's what I love about it. And that's why it's a progressive document. In terms of the Affordable Care Act cases, it's a perfect example. You know, when the founders wrote the Constitution and thought about interstate commerce, they, you know, of course they didn't think that, you know, in 2012 we'd have the healthcare industry comprise 20% of our nation's economy.
Right.
But it does. And when you look at the Constitution, what the folks who wrote it intended was to create a central government with the power to create national solutions to national problems.
And they had just been through, they had dealt with the Articles of Confederation. They knew what happened when the federal government was unable to referee squabbles between incredibly contentious individual states. So the Commerce Clause comes in as a direct response to that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Articles of Confederation were such a failure that George Washington once lamented that they nearly cost Americans victory in the Revolutionary War. And so they learned a lesson from that. They learned that we needed a sufficiently energetic federal government, and the Articles of Confederation did not have an interstate commerce clause.
No.
They made sure to put one in our enduring Constitution. And, you know, it's funny because the Tea Party talks on and on about the Constitution, but the version that they're talking about really has more in common with the Articles of Confederation.
Well, and I think that's what they ultimately want. You know, I'm a big fan of The Onion. And sometimes they get a little bit too close to reality. They had an article a year or so ago, and the title of it was, "Man is Passionate Defender of Constitution That Exists Only in His Head."
I remember that.
And I mean, I printed it out, and it's there for easy reference, because that's what I think of when I see the Tea Party out here talking about stuff. I had a woman who claimed to be a physician today telling me that the Affordable Care Act would prevent doctors from being able to prescribe mammograms, and just because she wanted to be non-sexist, and PSA tests for men.
Mm-hmm.
I've read the law. I read it when it was a bill. I've read it now.
Yeah.
It's a law. It's not in there. But they're willing to make things up as they go along.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk for a minute, if you please, about the General Welfare Clause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Justice Scalia has made it clear that he thinks that the general welfare, as referred to in the preamble, has it's meaningless, that the whole preamble is just meaningless. But that's not the only place that phrase exists, is it? There is greater reference to it within the body of the document, the ability of the Congress to make sure that the country functions in in a non-dysfunctional manner. And I guess that sounds a little goofy, but it's there, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and relevant to the case that we, the Affordable Care Act case and the arguments this morning and yesterday, which I was in the courtroom for.
So you did hear them?
Yeah. You know, the Congress has the power to tax and spend, quote, for the general welfare. And the Obama administration is arguing that the minimum coverage provision and the shared responsibility payment, if you don't have that minimum level of insurance, is a tax for the general welfare. You know, there are certainly other provisions of the Constitution, like the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause, that also support it. But, you know, and the other thing that I think is really interesting that, you know, these Tea Party historians certainly wouldn't tell you is that when the drafters of the Constitution were considering what powers to give to the federal government, they passed a resolution in the Constitutional Convention that would give the federal government, that they said, okay, when we're sitting down to write this, our guiding principle is going to be Resolution 6, which they passed. And it said that the federal government would have the power to act when the states were unable to act, when the states were acting in a way contrary to the interests of the union, and when it just was better for there to be a federal solution, a national solution, than individual state action. So this idea of the federal government being empowered to act in the best interest of the country as a whole was the motivating principle behind the enumerated powers in the Constitution.
Well, what then is the nexus with the Tea Party argument about, because they seem to have this standard response when you bring any of this up, and they start howling, Tenth Amendment. If the government is empowered to act, is empowered to act when the states either refuse to or act discordantly with national interest, what does that do to the Tenth Amendment and the reservation of rights?
Yeah, so, you know, the Tenth Amendment doesn't sort of negate the rest of the Constitution, which gives very strong powers to the federal government. So if you look at Article 1, Section 8, which gives power to Congress, including the power to regulate interstate commerce and tax and spend for the general welfare, those powers are granted to Congress. And what the Tea Partiers are trying to say when they invoke the Tenth Amendment is that they don't want Congress to exercise its constitutionally granted powers. But that's not how things work. The Tenth Amendment essentially just says, you know, Congress has to point to a power in the Constitution that it's using, as opposed to the states, which sort of have a, you know, more general power. Mm. But, you know, when Congress points to a particular power, the Commerce Clause power, for example, that power is limited only by the other provisions of the Constitution. So, you know, for example, in the healthcare law, if I wanted to pass a regulation that said, you know, you can engage in an unreasonable search and seizure of healthcare companies and records as part of the regulation, that wouldn't be okay because it would violate the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Sure.
But there's no right in the Constitution to freeload off one's neighbors if you choose to be self-insured and pass, you know, billions of dollars in uncompensated care costs onto the
people
rest
who are
of
being responsible.
Exactly, who are being responsible, playing by the rules, buying insurance, and end up paying, you know, the average family pays about $1,000 more every year in their premiums because of the uninsured.
Well, I'm a student of history, Elizabeth, and one of the things that drives me crazy out of all this, and frankly frightens me, is that so many of these arguments, and in fact some of the stuff that led this litigation to the Supreme Court today, has been sort of bathed or swaddled in a within the confines of nullificationism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the sort of thing that led us to that little dust-up in 1860 that there are so many monuments to around this town.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the states have a unilateral right to declare which federal laws they will and will not obey. I don't know if you saw it since you were there to witness the arguments, but Outside, there were some people with their Gadsden flag
mm-hmm.
and a sign that said, "We will not comply."
Mm-hmm.
This is frightening for our country. Is it disturbing to you?
It is. And I think the one thing that makes me feel better about it is that I represent state legislators from across the country and who are supporting the health care law, and there are other states and state leaders who have said that they do not agree with the, quote, states' rights position of the challenger states and of those folks who are standing outside with their flags. And, in fact, they're saying, don't tread on me to the challenging states, saying you don't represent what I think is the proper role between the states and the federal government. But I think it is concerning that there are people who clearly and vigorously believe that the states can not comply with validly enacted federal law. That is, our Constitution does not allow it. We fought a bloody civil war to bring that point home.
And the problem with the issue is that it didn't just crop up in 1859. This is something that has plagued our country for a big chunk of the 19th century, because it began with the tariff troubles with South mm-hmm. Carolina and the Jackson presidency. And he said he would go to South Carolina and hang the first person he saw, and he would continue hanging them until the, and that made South Carolina calm down for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course you get to 1860 and everything falls apart. What do you expect as someone who watches this process, who deals with state legislatures, what do you expect their next step to be if the Affordable Care Act is found to be constitutional, in fact? Is there going to be some great wave of civil disobedience that we're going to witness?
Well, you know, I hope what they do is what the founders thought they would do, which is to use the power of the ballot box. And, you know, I think that the Affordable Care Act is a great step in the right direction from a policy matter. But you know what? If you don't like it, don't try and make your arguments in the court. Don't try and seek a political do-over of what you couldn't accomplish in the legislature in the courts. That's not what the courts are there for, and that's not what this case is really about. This case is about the Constitution. And if the court finds it constitutional, and if you still think the law is a bad law and you don't want to have access to affordable, quality health care, then vote accordingly. But that's, there's no need to engage in civil disobedience.
But these are the self-same people who have not been slowed down since 1973 in Roe versus Wade. That's, you know, it's settled law and has been settled law for almost 40 years now, and they're not letting up. I grow, even though it provides me great fodder on a nightly basis for the show, I grow weary of it. And for the sake of my son, whom you saw a moment ago, and mm-hmm. my daughters at home, my grandchildren, I grow fearful of it for them. And I wonder if the country can stand another 50 years of this kind of divisiveness. It's frightening. The Constitution is a profoundly flexible, brilliant document, literally drafted by, no kidding, probably the greatest ingathering of geniuses that this nation may have ever known and may ever know. And I think people like Madison and the other framers, they anticipated a lot of things. They anticipated people of ill will. It's clear from mm-hmm. reading the Federalist Papers. You know, Federalist 10, when Madison
right.
talks about the poison of faction,
mm-hmm.
It's obvious there that he is literally thinking in the future, and he had the mind to do it. But I don't know if they anticipated people being so ill-informed, because that's the one break they cut the American people. They thought that they were going to really participate and care about their country.
Well, you know, there's maybe apocryphal, I don't know, but there's the story that when Benjamin Franklin was coming out on the streets while the Constitution was being drafted, a woman asked him, you know, what kind of government are you creating? And he said, a republic, madam, if you can keep it.
If you can keep it. We will end on that, Elizabeth Wydra. It is a pleasure talking to you. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
It's my
pleasure. I wish you all the best. I'd love to talk more about what you actually heard in there today. But
this is much more interesting.
Well, thank you very kindly.
Thank
have
you,
a wonderful
Bob.
Afternoon. Bye now. Elizabeth Wydra, and coming up, and I've been waiting to have that constitutional discussion for 2 days now, and it was wonderful. Joining us now, a man who I have no problem saying has assumed the mantle of a hero to me for what he has been willing to do over the past several years. Wendell Potter is with us now. Whistleblower, a man among men. Got some headphones here for you if they would help you any.
Very
at all.
Good. Thanks, Bob.
It was Wendell Potter who first made it abundantly apparent the manipulation, the outright evil that the insurance industry was engaging in where health care was concerned, and he joins us now. And thank you very much. I appreciate your time this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
We're seeing this. I'm sure you saw the protest as you came in. There's a lot of people. I'm pleased to say there's a lot of people out there supporting the Affordable Care Act, but there are a great number of people as well who are demanding the right for people to get sick and die without health care coverage, which I frankly can't wrap my mind around. You have seen the inside of the workings of the insurance industry. How much manipulation of the process, of the discussion of the Affordable Care Act has been driven from inside the PR operations of the healthcare industry?
Oh, it's been enormous. In fact, I would say that probably most of the manipulation can be traced back to the insurance industry. Keep in mind, there is a conventional wisdom that the insurance industry would like to see this law declared unconstitutional. It's not true. And so a lot of these folks who are out there protesting don't realize that those that they are presumably representing, or they're not representing their own best interest, that what the insurance industry would love to have more than anything else is that the Affordable Care Act go forward, but that these people who are out there marching will elect people who are more friendly to the insurance industry, that they'll control Congress next year, and they'll control the White House next year, so that they'll be more inclined to strip out the consumer protections in the Affordable Care Act. It's a very very sinister approach to government.
Cynical into the bargain too.
It is exactly, and they're very able. They're adept at manipulating public opinion. That's what I was part of for many years.
It would be wonderful to, for instance, have a mandate for a person to have to carry health care, and yet at the same time not have any requirements to provide anything going in the other direction. That's basically what we're talking about, isn't it?
It's what we're talking about. The insurance industry would love to be able to require us all to buy their products, but they don't want to live by the new regulations that are in the Act, the things that protect them from their worst practices that have led to 50 million of us not having insurance, and to enable them to refuse to sell us coverage when we get sick or after we've been sick, that enables them to cancel someone's coverage just because they want to.
Are you prepared to this is not confrontational, but are you prepared to say that we are reaching a time in America when the ability of people's illness, agony, suffering, death should not be a function of the profit motive? I mean, are we there yet?
We're not there yet because most people don't realize what the consequences have been since we allowed Wall Street to take over our healthcare system. But it'll become increasingly evident of what that really is. More and more of us are finding out that that the for-profit companies are more interested in meeting the bottom line expectations, meeting Wall Street's expectations, and one of the consequences of that soul-minded focus is on the rest of us, which is contributing to people not getting the care they need. There really are death panels. We've been, you know, some of these people who are marching out here are saying and believing that the Affordable Care Act would set up death panels. It does not, but they do exist, and they exist today inside these big for-profit health insurance companies, any health insurance company that operates today, and they're just not recognizing it.
Well, I just spoke to a young woman just a few minutes ago whose father was put through the living hell of trying to get a bone marrow transplant. Hmm. And he was, of course, denied. And then eventually they gave in after the cancer had come back and after he became basically... The insurance companies... delay tactics were, in essence, a death sentence.
And they often are.
And that's the function of a real death panel, isn't it?
It really is. I tell the story of a young 17-year-old girl who was scheduled to have a liver transplant.
I know this story.
And
Cigna?
Cigna was her family's health insurer. She was scheduled to have a liver transplant that her doctors felt would save her life, and that she would live at least 5 years. She had leukemia, and the family's doctors, or the girl's doctors, had a liver waiting to transplant into her. When the insurance company said, sorry, we're not going to cover this because we don't think it's medically appropriate for Nataline Sarkeesian, that was the girl's name.
Yes.
So you see, what we have in this country, we have people who work for big insurance companies making these kinds of decisions. The person who made that decision had not seen Nataline, had not examined her, had just made an opinion based on some paperwork that he didn't want to pay for her liver transplant.
And let's be clear, there are a lot of these stories, and this is a function. There are structures within health insurance companies in which people are paid year-end bonuses based on the coverage they have denied. I mean, that's the truth, isn't it?
It is true. In fact, one company in California had to pay a considerable fine when it was disclosed that the company actually had paid employees' bonuses to find reasons to cancel people's coverage. This is how, you know, there are many ways that these companies avoid paying for our care when we think that they're obligated to do so.
Well, let me ask you this then, and I think this is, if there's a troubling aspect to the Affordable Care Act, this is it or part of it. Given the way that we have seen health insurance companies behave, can they be trusted with any portion the ACA as it is presently constituted? Even if there are mandatory obligations put upon them, for instance, you know, no rejections for pre-existing conditions, that sort of thing, isn't their natural inclination, Mr. Potter, going to be to constantly look for loopholes, to find ways to short circuit people's coverage?
Yes, that is true. But my hope is, and my belief is, that the Affordable Care Act will make health insurance coverage less profitable for them than it has been in the past. They will not be able to do some of the things that we've talked about that have enabled them to make such big profits. And these companies are already diversifying. They're getting into other businesses that they think can provide a bigger profit margin. So my belief is that ultimately these companies that are for profit will get out of the business of providing basic coverage, and that we'll go back to having nonprofit companies do that, at least as an interim step before we get to a more equitable solution for our health, to bring more people into universal
moving
coverage.
Moving toward a universal health care sort of model.
Right.
How much within the for-profit health care industry, how much actually goes to health care provision as opposed to advertising and, you know, imprinted golf balls for physicians and all the little gym cracks and things, and
and then ultimately bonuses and massive salaries. In other words, if they were running on a leaner, more Medicare resemblant model, what would happen inside insurance? Would they just walk away from the business?
Yeah, they would. It would change so radically that they'd walk away from it. We spend in this country about over $2 trillion a year on health care in one way or another, and it's estimated that about 30% of that is spent on various what they call administrative functions, and that includes the golf balls, the imprinted golf balls.
I'm sorry, that's just my...
Yeah, but it's true. It's true. And the ability of CEOs to travel on private jets and to be paid enormous salaries. The guy who last year was at the very top of Forbes' most highly compensated CEO list was the president of one of these big for-profit companies. They pay their executives enormous amounts of money. But the other thing is that the way that we have our insurance system in this country, it means that the health care providers also have to spend enormous amounts of money on administration that they otherwise wouldn't have to spend. Doctors' offices and hospitals have to have armies of staff people who do nothing more than just deal day in and day out with insurance companies and trying to make sure that they get paid, and the insurance company
coders and right,
and the insurance company people want to try to do all they can to make sure they don't pay them what they should be paying them.
It strikes me that you understand. One understands that in a legal situation, that our system is predicated on an adversarial system.
It is.
And you know, you can understand that there's one side, there's two sides to every fight, and sometimes ten. But in the process of trying to get someone cured of cancer, or trying to get a heart transplant in light of recent news, that shouldn't be adversarial, should it? The adversarial nature of the relationship is created by the profit motive, isn't it?
It is. And in this country, probably more than any other country, we have this notion that everything is better if it's done in a competitive way. But that does set up these adversarial relationships that you're speaking of. What we really need more of is collaboration, in which the various entities work more collaboratively to ensure that a patient has...
Where everybody's going in the same direction.
That's exactly right. And when you do that, you can begin to take the cost out of the systems, out of the system, and make sure that people have the outcomes for people are where they should be.
Well, I can only hope that we get toward a universal system sooner rather than later. Do you have any sense... I want to back up. You said it's not necessarily that the insurance companies want to see the Affordable Care Act overturned. They just want to, because they've got to like the idea of having mandatory customers.
They do. They like that. And the
less they can do for them, the better.
That's exactly right.
Then, do you have any idea which way... If they're not driving this opposition to the Affordable Care Act, it can't all be the Tea Party. Where's the real force behind this opposition?
Well, keep in mind that much of this is a smokescreen for what the insurance industry really wants. I mean, this is the impression that the industry and a lot of its allies really want this overturned. It's not true. It's a smokescreen for what they really want to do, which is to keep the individual mandate intact. And keep in mind that the individual mandate was an idea that originated in a conservative think tank here in Washington.
The Heritage Foundation,
The Heritage
right?
Foundation. So it is a conservative idea that was sold to the president and Democratic leaders as maybe a way to get bipartisan support.
Well, this is the Dole plan from 1992.
Absolutely is. So it is a plan that has been embraced by conservative politicians and even by Republican candidates for president right now.
Well, then to a certain extent, are we bearing witness to some sort of great kabuki play?
Absolutely. It's enormous deception. It's very, very devious what's going on. That's why I wrote the book called Deadly Spin, to try to pull the curtains back on how this is done and why it's done. It's all very devious. is all done very much behind the scenes. A lot of our premium dollars are our money is funneled into campaigns to make us second guess the reasons for having health care reform, not to overturn it, not to get it repealed, but to elect people who are friends of the insurance industry so that when they're in office, they will strip out the consumer protections and leave what the insurance industry wants, which
likes.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're going. In essence, they're hoping that the Supreme Court will take a scalpel to the statute and not a butcher knife.
That's right. And they are so successful in manipulating public opinion that you've got people here in town who are outside marching and calling for the law to be declared unconstitutional.
Cannon fodder in the culture wars.
Absolutely, what it is.
Wendell Potter, I've hoped to have a conversation with you for a very long time. I'm glad it finally came true today.
Me too.
Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we are back. I am joined now. It's about 7 minutes past the hour. I'm joined by Celinda Lake. She is president of Lake Research Partners. She's a political strategist with the Democratic Party. And she does the tactical work and advisory work to the National Party committees. And so I would suggest that it is probably a good bet that Ms. Lake, you can probably speak to questions of what if on either end of the decisional spectrum with regard to the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
What happens to the Democratic Party? Yeah, I would prefer that this be a discussion, I don't mean yours and mine,
mm-hmm.
but the larger national discussion, I would prefer that it be a discussion about whether people can go to the doctor when they're sick.
Amen.
Unfortunately, we have a political chattering class that would prefer to make it about a horse race or some sort of meaningless statistical squabble. But with that in mind,
are totally fictitious things like death panels, which don't exist.
I got up this morning, and all of the morning news programs are completely worthless to me.
Wow.
So I defaulted over to Morning Joe simply for the circus-like entertainment quality. I heard exactly what you're discussing or what you're describing. There sat Joe Scarborough describing things about the Affordable Care Act that completely did not exist.
It's amazing. I mean, fiction as fact is just unbelievable. But I think the most important thing, and you raise it, is to have a conversation about what are the real components. You know what's ironic? Even though the voters today, first of all, most voters say they're not paying attention. Most voters say they don't know what's in the bill. They're remarkably honest here. But the people that have an opinion tend to lean against the bill, and it tends to be very much on partisan lines. When we have a conversation, though, about what's in the bill, every single provision of this act, except for the mandate, is popular between 65 and 85% of the voters like it. That's more popular than every single politician who will oppose this bill. So our job is to make this about the conversation about health care and our goals in health care reform, not about politics.
I will go so far as to say that from the view from where I sit has been one for a number of years where it has felt like our side has been in a constant mode of playing catch up,
mm-hmm.
and planned reacting and being That's reactive
right.
instead of proactive in our messaging. Why is that, and how do we change it?
Boy, the why is a long question. And first
that's,
of all,
is that the six-hour radio?
That's
show
a six-hour radio show, but I'd love to be a panelist on it. And it is frustrating. I think part of it is that we tend to think that facts matter more than they do. And as you can see on Morning Joe, that the fiction is far more powerful than the facts. I think that we don't seize control of it early enough and define what the legislation is really about. I think we're not as powerful on message. We don't tend to think about what our message is, and then we shy away from talking about it. We should have leaned into health care reform. We should have been defining it from the get-go, and actually I'm really glad that the president at least has signaled that for better or for worse, he's going to talk about it, because either you talk about it now and define it, or that's all we talk about in September and October, and we're on the defense again.
Is that one of the beauties of at least having this thing decided in June?
It's a beauty of having it decided in June, and I think it's also a beauty of having the presidency, because we have the bully pulpit to define what this thing is all about. And we have the ability to say to people, what do you want to do? Do you want to take away free prevention visit for grandma? Do you want to do away with insurance companies covering birth control, which is expensive for a lot of families in these tough economic times? Do you want to allow an insurance company to deny a child coverage because they have a so-called pre-existing condition? Do you want to take your 25-year-old kid who doesn't have a job and is back on your couch off of health insurance? I mean, which one of these things do you want to do?
And see, that's exactly how this discussion needs to have gone forward, and it seems
like it's exactly how it hasn't.
I agree with you. It's very frustrating.
These out of an abundance of trying to be decent, I'll call them Tea Party people. It's not the phrase I usually use. When I hear them say, "Oh, it's about my liberty," "It's about my freedom." Well, how free are you if you're free to die uninsured from something that is utterly preventable,
right?
If you've got coverage, because that's a reality. We have American citizens who die every year to the tune of 45 to 48,000 people. They don't die because they got some disease that can't be treated. They died because they got something and couldn't be treated because they didn't have insurance. I mean, we need the AMA to define a new disease.
Right.
Called,
death by lack of insurance.
Yeah, an insurance-itis or whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
Something Greek, the absence of insurance.
That's right.
And whether it's freedom or liberty or, you know, this latest thing where suddenly the right wing are the only people on the planet who have consciences, I mean, it makes me nuts. And
also, think about the number of families that went bankrupt because of health care. Freedom to lose your house, freedom to lose everything you save for when you paid for your insurance. Also, if you have secret ceilings in your policies because you're a cancer survivor, if you have a pre-existing condition, this doesn't even mean when you don't have insurance. This means freedom to go bankrupt when you have insurance.
Yes.
And you've been paying your premiums your entire life.
We're not talking about the boys under the bridge drinking the screw top wine. No, I had Spike Ward on earlier.
Yeah.
She was talking about, you know, that L.A. Times op-ed that she wrote where she said, you know, we're good people. We have a house. We've been responsible.
Worked all their lives. Paid their insurance premiums their whole lives.
And still get hung out to dry.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, I don't know how many Tea Party people are that way. You know, one disaster away from everything falling apart, but I suspect it's probably a much larger number than they suspect.
Right, that's right.
And yet, right now, down there at the South Park of the Senate,
right,
they're losing their, you know, they're having their little, I don't know, snake handling thing, you know, whatever it is they do. And I wonder, from your standpoint of your expertise in dealing with women's political issues, getting women candidates elected within a progressive framework.
Mm-hmm.
Can we turn this to our advantage in November? And I speak specifically toward, you know, I'm not that worried about President Obama.
Right.
I know it's a fight. I know it
right.
is.
That's
a lot
right.
There's a lot of ugly Citizens United money out there. I get that. But is there even some remote chance of retaking the House? Can we save the Senate?
Yeah.
You know, a second Obama term in which he spends 4 years just
right
beating back the reactionary impulses of a Republican House and Senate, I mean, that's too much. That's almost as bad as the alternative.
That's exactly right. I would say this. I am a huge believer in our ability to take back the House. And I also think that for the first time we have the ability to take back the House with progressives, not with these blue dogs who vote like Republicans. This is amazing. And yet we can't get anybody focused on it. We only need 25 seats. There are 14 seats that Kerry and Obama won. There are another 5 seats that look good for us because of Obama and because of reapportionment. That takes us to 19 seats. All we have to do is get 6 more seats, and we have control of the House. We can do this.
Does the DCCC understand that?
Well, they really understand it, and they're working hard on it. But all of our funders on our side don't tend to believe in it, don't tend to understand it. And that's what we need.
I'm guilty because I've preached that it's a foregone conclusion that it's not going to happen.
Ah.
So, no, I'm happy to be corrected. Because, no,
you're breaking my heart here.
Well, no, I'm sorry, because what I saw was, you know, in 2010,
yeah,
we saw those blue dog imitation Republican light members of Congress get bounced in favor
right.
of having the real brand.
Right.
And, you know, in light of the fact that those people were in places like Tennessee and Alabama
yeah.
and Georgia and Mississippi and so Oklahoma, whatever, to the extent that they were there, I just didn't see their constituents saying, no, we're suddenly feeling very progressive. and undoing that. But you're telling me that there are opportunities outside those places.
That's right. There are opportunities outside those places. And also in a presidential year, some of those places don't look the same. I mean, here are two things. We saw the participation of people of color, of young people, and of unmarried women absolutely collapse in 2010.
Yes.
And we also saw women vote Republican for the first time in 37 years. If we get independent women back, and if we get people of color, younger people, and unmarried women turn out up, we can win. And the presidency helps a lot with that. And frankly, the healthcare issue helps a lot with that. Healthcare is a women's issue. And talking to independent women about, you know what, we're going to make sure that the insurance company covers your birth control. We're not going to let being a woman be a pre-existing condition. And while it's mildly annoying that you get charged more for your dry cleaning, it's really enraging that you get charged more for your healthcare. And we're going to make that illegal, too.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful messaging. It really is. I've seen all this war on women stuff, and it's revolting to me as a guy. I'm
right,
you know?
Exactly.
Because sooner or later, if they're going after birth control pills, I've tried to tell guys, you know, I'm going to quit with it. They're going to go after the condoms, too. It's not like you're going to get a pass.
Right, that's exactly
birth control is birth control.
That's right, and it's a family decision.
Theocracy.
Right. And once politicians start choosing what's in your insurance plan, then where do they go? Do they go to HIV medication? Do they say heart medication?
Sure.
What other judgment do they make?
What I guess I'm asking though is that from the standpoint of the Republican war on women, is it, because I saw one, I forget whose poll it was, CBS maybe, that said women really didn't care about the war on women. Do you have data to the contrary?
Yeah, we do. And first of all, the war on women honestly isn't the best term. It's kind of a political term. It's kind of an aggressive term. But women care a lot about being in touch with their lives. Women care a lot about whether politicians are making decisions that should be personal decisions. And interestingly, when you get to the specifics and you talk about 65% of women and 60% of men, to your point, disagree that employers should be able to deny coverage for birth control because they don't believe in it because it's not their religion. Fine, that's your religion. That's not my religion. You shouldn't have a say over what is in
Said you're the only one in this country with a conscience?
Right.
I was out protesting the Iraq war. What? That didn't matter?
Right.
I didn't get to withhold my taxes.
Right, exactly right. So I think that these are very powerful issues. They're powerful with men and women. And the nice thing about the Tea Partiers, and here's another piece of evidence about why we can take back the House. Usually by now, people who had taken such wildly unpopular positions would be saying, oh, I was misunderstood. I really meant
this. You took me out of context.
Right, you took me out of context. Now they're saying, oh, no, I believe in doing away with Medicare. Here's my second attempt to do it. These people are unrepentant. Voters voted for change. They did not vote for this kind of change, and they'll reject this kind of change.
Ms. Lake, I certainly hope that you are correct. And
thanks to your help for making it happen.
Oh, I don't know how much I'm helping, but it's been a joy meeting you. And
nice to be on your show. Thank you.
I hope that down the road we get to have a little bit more in the way of conversation because we need smart messaging out there. And you know, I want a president who's going. I know a lot of people have gotten real cranky, but I really do. I want to see the bully pulpit stuff in the next
absolutely. You and me both.
I'm not demanding that he take his shoe off and pound on the podium like Khrushchev or anything, but it would be nice to see some out front advocacy.
That's right, and he's doing it more and more, and it's making a big difference.
Thank you
so much.
Have a great day. Bye now. Celinda Lake, a delightful conversation. It was indeed. With her talking messaging like that, I hope that the Democratic Party is listening.
Oh, thanks. You're really nice.
Throw rocks if you have to.
I will.
All right. Take care. Hi. Just 1 second. Weren't on my schedule, but you are now.
I've got to go on a piece of paper.
then your piece of paper wins.
Let's see. Are you Bob Kincaid?
I am.
Here you go.
Don't worry, it happens all the time.
Okay. Well, you know, it's cool. The only downside to this is I don't have a bio, so we will start from ground. We will start from the very ground. You are Cincy Hernandez Cancio, and you are the director of Health Equity, and you're with Families USA, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful. Let's start then very plainly. What is the nature of your advocacy?
So I work in Families USA, focused on making sure that people of color both understand the importance of healthcare reform and also working on issues of making sure that the implementation of healthcare reform is done in a way that maximizes health equity. In other words, that minimizes healthcare disparities in this country.
Okay. Within that description, then, I guess maybe I'm engaging in wishful thinking. But has convincing the community of color that the Affordable Care Act is good for them, has that been an uphill struggle or is it challenging?
Well, the challenge has not been so much changing people's minds. The challenge is that there's just not a lot of information out there in a way that people can digest. And we've seen this across the board, not just with communities of color, that, for example, you look at polling and you ask people what do they think of Obamacare and they don't like it so much, but when you start telling them exactly what's in it, they love it. So that's
right, Obamacare hate it. Yeah. You think of telling insurance companies that they can't just throw you off your coverage willy-nilly. Well, that's the way it ought to be.
Right, exactly. Right. You know, what do you think about the fact that your kid, when he graduates from college, can still stay on your plan until he's 26? Yay, we love that. You know, what do you think of preventive care without copays? Fantastic. So the challenge is more making sure that people, regular people, that we talk to people. Here in Washington, it's very hard for us to remember to talk to people like just normal people talk, because we don't talk like normal people here,
yeah,
right?
This is a different place.
So it's a challenge across the board, and then it becomes even more challenging. You have to make sure that you're dealing with the right, you know, representatives, you know, the trusted sources of information, that you are, you know, saying things in a culturally that really relates to the real reality of the people you're talking to. And then with Latinos and some other groups and Asian American groups, then you have other issues of language as well that you want to make sure that the message is coming out in ways people understand.
Is it?
There are a lot of us that have been working on this. Actually, even HHS has been working even more on trying to get this information out. You know, for example, their healthcare.gov site is actually Cuidado de Salud, you know, in Spanish. So they're working on it. I think all of us understand that we have to do a lot better. And we are trying our best to coordinate and collaborate to do a better job on this.
Well, one of the things that, and we were having this discussion a little bit earlier today, is, for instance, on January 1st, 2014, when what I think is one of the most exciting parts of the Affordable Care Act comes into play, the Medicaid expansion. I don't think of necessarily demographics as much as I think of fungigraphics, namely poor folks.
Mm-hmm.
How, whether it's DHHS or NGOs or whatever, how do you, on January 1st, 2014, how do you let people know, you know, hooray, good for you, this is a great day for America, this is a great day for you, you are no longer uninsured?
Well, I'm so glad you've asked that question, because it's hugely important. I mean, as you know, Latinos, for example, have the group with the highest rates of uninsurance. 1 in 3 Latinos don't have insurance. 1 in 4 black people don't have insurance. And then if you add and layer over that the income levels, we know for sure that the groups that are most likely to benefit and benefit the greatest from some the coverage expansions, not only Medicaid, but also the exchange subsidies for working class people. And we can't wait till, as you said, January 1st, 2014 to do that. There are groups, and we've been working with a variety of groups, including a group called Enroll America, that's laser focused on making sure that we have the public education campaigns starting next year, not 2014, but starting next year, so that the word is out and people know that they have options. Because right now people are really struggling. People don't know what to do, and they don't know that there's options out there for them. So it's very important that we, and they're used to that. They're used to going without. So we need to change that dynamic so that people say, you know, guess what? You don't have to go without, and there are options for your family. You can take care of yourself and your family members, and you don't have to suffer the way you've been suffering for so long anymore.
And I have to think that will be a huge moment for people to just breathe a tremendous sigh of relief, whether it be pre-existing conditions or, as you described, the exchanges themselves, all of those mechanisms that are in there. It's going to be a tremendous relief for people.
And I think it's incredibly important that we be, as I was talking with Ms. Lake, that we be messaging on this right now.
And actually, people are breathing huge sighs of relief right now. You know, the mom who doesn't have to worry about their young adult who just graduated having health care, there are 2.5 million parents out there right now breathing enormous sighs of relief about that. There are many seniors, millions of seniors right now who are breathing huge sighs of relief over the fact that they don't have to pay so much in the donut hole. They can get their medications covered. All of the parents of children with some serious, you know, children that are born with birth defects or children with, like, serious asthma, mm-hmm. who don't have to worry about their insurance company denying them for pre-existing conditions. That's all in play already. And then there's all, for those of us who already have insurance, all those protections. You know, knowing that for every $5 you spend on a premium, a company can't pay, use more than one for profits and overhead, that's like a relief to me, that who keeps paying, you know, paying out, paying out for premiums.
It stuns me to this day that that's in the legislation. You know, that kind of what are we going to call that? An extravagance cap?
Yeah. The greed cap?
Yeah. It amazes me that it's in there. And again, it's something that I never would have known about had I not been coming to these events.
Yeah.
And if I'm plugged into this stuff and I don't know, I gotta wonder the degree to which.
That is a challenge.
A lot of people don't.
And that is a challenge. And how about the fact that, you know, an insurance company can't raise your premium more than 10% without permission? Did you know about that?
Yeah. If permission
from the state.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a review. You know, they have to justify the fact that they really are increasing their costs, not their overhead, not what Mr. Potter
and I described. Yeah,
not the profit that they're going to pay out, you know, the dividends they're paying out for
the
their investors. Yeah, exactly.
The CEO's Ferrari,
but that they actually really did have to increase their premiums that much. You know, there's some people who are going to be getting checks in the mail about that. But again, a lot for us to educate.
Well, Cincy Hernandez Concio, and I've got the name right.
You did very well.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you coming by, and I thank you for the information. And I
thank you so much.
Thank you most of all for the dedication of your work.
Thank you. I really appreciate
that.
You're
working on the side of the angels.
I hope so.
I know so. Take care. From Families USA, Director of Health Equity, Cincy Hernandez Concio. And we will move on to Bob Wiener, my old buddy. I was wondering if we were going to get to talk.
Well, we make a point of it with you.
And you're my last guest of the day, so.
Well, I'm honored. Are we live?
Yeah, we absolutely are. Well, I'm about half. I've been up since about 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a headset there for you.
If you're live, you're more than our case in the court right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you haven't heard?
No.
Robert said if we do the mandate, it takes us to broccoli and gyms. I mean, it's just what was predicted.
What
we predicted in our op-ed.
What's the broccoli business?
Force you to eat broccoli if they force you to have health care. It's such a bullshit argument. Anyway, we can do that.
That's okay. And by the way, we can say that on the Internet, that word.
You can?
Yeah. I like broccoli.
Well, you have the right to like it or not like it. I respected George Bush's not liking it.
So you're obviously tuned in. You're the first.
I made a point of it. You know, you do homework before you walk over. You know. So.
Yeah. But
I listened to Tubin, who said that the case is going down. That's what Jeff Tubin's assessment was on CNN.
Well, I just had an email from my head writer, who said in an email titled "Well, damn it."
But it was predictable. Who thought? Did anybody think the Bush v. Gore and the Citizens United case court would do anything different but go 5-4 on this?
I had Rick Unger sitting right where you're sitting yesterday saying it was going to be 7-2, 8-1 in favor.
What Tubin said was the only thing you can say about the four liberal justices is that there's four of them.
Jesus. Now, David just wrote to me a little bit ago and says the tenor of the NPR coverage is that the SCOTUS will rule against the ACA. These are the same sort of justice types that thought slavery was ordained by God in 1830.
Well, I don't go there. But, I mean, I go to Bush v. Gore and Citizens United and predictable on the basis of who appointed them. You know, I'm a practical progressive, not a fringy one. So.
Well, but I'm a mean one, and I know what the Tawney Court was.
Right, yeah.
It was not all Dred Scott, but they gave us Dred Scott.
Yeah. But I do want to use the line of the Republicans claim they want liberty, but they want to have liberty and death, because death is what you get without health insurance, 20,000 people.
Well, and see, that's the thing, Bob. It's
give me liberty and give me death.
No, their version of liberty is out of a song, okay? This is me and Bobby McGee, okay? This is freedom's nothing more than nothing left to lose. And that's what they mean when they talk about freedom.
The press release that I want to work on.
No,
I need mine. Yeah, the one that's marked up somewhere.
Okay.
It was right here.
We were talking about a piece. Is this Bad Signs from the Supreme Court?
You got that one. That's good. That's my release that I work on. And here it is. Okay. The one where I've circled stuff.
Okay, so we are talking about the same thing.
That's yours.
But you're free to use it.
No, but it means I left one.
Then that may be yours, because it's not mine.
No. I had a... Where's my blue pen? The goal is the last interview I had. And then I've got another one. But okay.
Mostly.
All right. Anytime you're ready, I'm ready.
I'm born ready.
Okay.
So... this is titled Bad Signs from the Supreme Court for Health Law.
Oh, have we been on all this time?
Yeah, we're on. Yeah, we're...
We've been on all this time. I didn't even know. I thought we were just...
No. This is live radio, baby. This is the crash of the Hindenburg. I mean, yeah, no, we're doing great, man. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. But no, you've written Bad Signs from the Supreme Court for Health Law... And it was just terrible in there today, right?
Well, you had the Chief Justice saying that if we can do this, there's no limits. And exactly what we were afraid of, and what I put in my October Palm Beach Post article that I hope people have the chance to read, which is called Why is the Obama Administration So Confident? I think I'm the only National Democratic strategist that said this court will vote 5-4 against. Because this is a case where you have rich guys in robes with federal health insurance themselves who have no clue about poor and average people who need many wouldn't have adequate health insurance without the bill. It took generations for Congress to pass. And it's really tragic, Bob. And I really am sad that that's what American justice has come to, is you have four justices who will vote in favor of the American people and five who go Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, injecting money back into politics and now take away health care from the people that was duly and legitimately voted by the Congress.
And they're not just five Supreme Court justices. These are the very kinds of justices that the right wing talk about when they say activist judges legislating from the bench. Congress has certain powers, and they're supposed to, the rules of construction say that they're supposed to afford significant deference to the power of Congress unless it's proven to be abusive or arbitrary and capricious, that kind of standard of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But these five, they have an ideology that trumps constitutional interpretation, constitutional construction, equal justice concepts. All of that is trumped by the fact that they are owned. You know, the fact that Justice Thomas is even still participating in this thing drives me
awful.
Crazy, Bob.
Awful, with his wife getting money and saying that she's an ambassador to the Tea Party, getting money from the opposition to the bill, and yet the Supreme Court recuses themselves from judicial ethics that every other court in America has to have, that says you can't do exactly that.
Right.
But, you know, you mentioned activism and power to the people. With the Republicans and the right-wing court, that's unless it's activism that gives the American people their own power that they don't want to give them, and unless it takes the power away that they want to take away. Take a look at what happened in Bob McDonald's Virginia and Rick Perry's Texas. Forced transvaginal ultrasound probes inside women's bodies, which the World Health Organization defines putting a probe in a woman's body as rape.
Yes.
That is the world definition of rape. And then the Doonesbury final column, which right-wing censors wanted to take away from some people, says, and the final indignity, now here's your bill. They are making women pay for this rape that they didn't want themselves. And then you have the governor of Tennessee who says, Well, they cannot look at it when it's thrown into their faces with the sonogram on the screen. What an outrage. That's their idea of no mandate? That is a horrible mandate, and that's what they want to do for health care. But they don't want people to have the right to have health care. To them, that's a mandate. But it's not a mandate when you push a probe into a woman's body.
You know, I saw they were over there. I went walking around in the zoo before the program started. I like to see those people. They're so strange. And the guy standing up there that says, health care does not exist in nature. It is not a natural right.
Yeah, you know what the lifespan was when I was a kid and my grandfather, I was looking up to him for old age? 20 years less than it is now. When I was a kid, the lifespan was 56 for men. It is now 76 for men and 80 for women. There are three reasons for it. One is health care and medicine. The other is nutrition. We've learned that you don't eat fats and you don't eat butter and you don't drink whole milk. You try to do less stuff, you know, skim milk and margarine. And all. And the third, and chicken and fish and less red meat. And the third is physical fitness. We've learned that you have to go to a gym every other day for a half hour. And that actually, the Washington Post says, adds 9 years to your life in their study of all the studies. So health care should be a right, not a privilege. And yet,
because it's the right. Wait a minute, this is one of theirs, isn't it? Isn't it the right to life, Bob?
There you go. But the right to life doesn't exist if it's a good benefit for people. It only exists if you want to take something from people.
Right.
Then
the
it's a right,
right
to
the
life.
Right, the right to life doesn't exist if you're outside the womb.
Yeah.
If you're,
The hypocrisy of the right wing is astounding, that they can be right to life but no health care, no benefits. Take away food stamps, which is what they're doing in their budget. Take away education, which adds life and quality of life to you. Take away those things and spend the money and give the tax breaks to rich people. To them, that's what the rights of America should be. And it's really an incredible difference in philosophy. So, you know, one thing you can say politically, if this case goes down, the American people could go into outrage. The Republicans may not realize it, but before they put in their propagandizing and their hundreds of millions of dollars of publicity, before every time there is a health care bill, the American people support by a 15-point majority health care for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So if this bill goes down, we're going to swing back to an overwhelming desire by the American people for health care. And it's just outrageous that that they have bought their way into opposing this bill and even persuading the Supreme Court to do it.
But, Bob, you message on this stuff so very well. I mean, you are one of the true pros out there. But our side doesn't have that many.
Terrible.
The right wing is going to be ready in either outcome, regardless of what the outcome is. If they were to uphold the Affordable Care Act, the right wing will be ready to start a
right.
scorched earth war
right.
that'll last 40 years, just like the war has over Roe versus Wade, which will be 40 years old next year.
Right.
If they should happen to win and the ACA be stricken down, then the right wing is also going to be ready to defend against any efforts by Democrats and progressives to make those miserable bastards pay.
You're so right, Bob. Clooney was on TV on all the cables saying the Democrats have a terrible message machine, the Republicans have a killer closed message machine. Why can't the Democrats have it? And I don't know the answer, because under Bill Clinton, we did. We had Rahm, we had Begala, we had Carville. Those were aggressive, forceful people. I was proud to be part of that team. I was on the White House press staff during that team. And I learned from them that you've got to go for it, and you got to go for it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, A, B, C, D, E.
Right, and you don't let them get away with nothing.
Here's what I found. When I was on, I sneaked onto being a regular on Fox and Friends in the morning as the token House progressive Democrat, so I get my say here and there. But they still try to play, and they try to cut me off. So I was ticking off the provisions of the health bill a few months ago, and I was going, children's care through 26, and cheaper and free drugs for seniors, pre-existing conditions coverage, and suddenly they're cutting me off. They're saying, we don't want to talk about the bill. We want to talk about the title of the bill. Isn't it a killer bill? No, it's not a killer bill. And then I go back into it. I said, no lifetime caps, not being thrown off of sick, free prevention, mammograms and colonoscopies, and 85% of the premiums have to go to benefits in healthcare, not oversight for the insurance companies and high salaries. So John Stewart picked up on Fox trying to cut me off, And he made a joke of it, and I got it up on my website. It was wienerpublic.com, by the way, to to your listeners.
Yeah.
And Stewart said on the Daily Show, he played my clip and being cut off, then he played, and then here he goes again, putting the list through again. And he said, Wiener, what part of we don't want our viewers to know what's in the bill don't you understand?
Yeah.
And that was his joke.
And
there's
a
total truth to the Republicans trying to stop that. When I was on an airplane before I went on Fox, I was, you know, I role play wherever I am. I was role playing, you know, I'm desperate. I'm role playing to the flight attendant, right?
Yeah.
About what I'm going to say on TV. And he says, you know, I don't like the bill. And I said, you know, it's got children's care through 26, cheaper drugs for seniors, pre-existing conditions covered, no lifetime caps, not being thrown off if sick, free mammograms and colonoscopies, and 85% has to go to benefits to people. And he said, gee, if I knew all that's in the bill, that's a good bill. And that's your flight attendant on the airplane before I go on TV. So, and by the way, Bob is knocking his head on the mic for our listeners who don't understand.
Yeah,
know what
they're used to it. So,
That's the deal, is the Republicans don't want people to know what's in the bill.
I have been getting, and granted, I mean, Families USA has done a magnificent job pulling this radio row together, and they've the other affiliated organizations have brought folks in here, and they've had a profound presence out in front of the Supreme Court. And yet...
Well, I'll tell you, this profound presence, let's be honest with our listeners, there's 200 people out there. Do you really think...
I thought that was more than 200
Do you
people.
Really... I just walked right by it.
Okay.
Do you really think that 200 people that the justices know are going to be pro and they're going to be against and their stage demonstrations really going to impact them?
I wish it
were true, but it's not going to happen.
I'm not concerned with it. I don't think the justices consider much of that one way or the other, so much as it is a representation to the rest of the people that there is support for the bill. And frankly, the right-wing message.
And they got the right-wing has their 50 people saying, no health care now, no health. So
and that's the other thing. For two months now, Bob, for some reason or other, I get right-wing emails. I don't know why. Some people get up in the morning and they read the comics. I get up and I read right-wing press releases. For 2 months, I've been getting press releases from the right-wing telling me that, and then I got it right here, thousands of people will descend on Washington, D.C. on March
thousands.
The 27th. And
there are more people in Radio Row right here with you and me than there are out on the...
Well, but the thing is, if you go down, and I did, if you go down to Senate Park South, down past the Russell House, the Russell Senate Office Building, that's where they were gathering.
Oh, okay.
They've got, you know, one of the portable stages. They've got their little portable Klieg lights
good
up.
Enough.
They've got a media riser. There's 8 cameras there. They've coordinated coverage. I mean, they've done everything
right.
they need to do. On the other hand,
we got nothing. Yeah.
Well, no, we don't have nothing. This is not nothing.
No, here you're talking about Radio
but
Row.
I'm talking about outside.
I've noticed, and I want to be straight about this one too. Radio Row has enormous power.
Yes.
I remember when the bill was coming up, and we got to do the same thing again. When the bill was coming up, you and I made the point that this is nonsense that the Senate says it has to go to 60. And we said, call Reid. Rahm was the chief of staff to the White House,
yeah.
And Reid is the Senate leader. And we said, call them. We gave their phone numbers and tell them we don't want 60. We want the Constitution allows under, what's it called, sequestration or whatever the term was at the time. And the Constitution allows a vote with 50, not 60, and so we can get a vote on the bill. We got it a week later, Reid reversed and Rahm reversed and said, we're going to allow the 50 votes instead of the 60 and call it part of the... We actually won that and got the health care bill because of the power of Radio Row.
And
we've got to do that again here now.
That's why this is so important, what goes on here, because the other thing, having been coming to these Radio Rows for a while now,
right.
Bob, I'm seeing more and more and varied people and new faces. We don't have near the power that right-wing radio has because we don't have nearly the support.
But if we laser-focus and target what we do...
It's growing, and the ability to focus is growing as well.
Don't forget that Ed Schultz started from Radio Row kinds of things.
Yeah.
And he's a big... And Rachel and all of that. So we got our say now a little bit.
Right, and that's what...
Except that Fox tops CNN and MSNBC combined. So,
well, see, yeah. No, there's another statistic out there I don't know if you're aware of or not, but it's the one that drives me crazy. It sends me running screaming into the night. And it remains true that for every hour of progressive radio there is in this country, there are 1,000 hours of right-wing hate.
Yeah.
1,000 to 1.
But they put their feet in their mouth, like Rush has done. So that helps.
Well, and it does help. But by the same token, he diverts from other messaging. You know, because
yeah.
I mean, I've got a very smart audience, and they were, okay, Bob, not one more night talking about Rush, not one more, Bob.
Okay.
And so I didn't, I need reminders like that from time to time that there are other things out there.
Yeah.
Hey,
how about
Dick Cheney's heart transplant?
But they forgot to connect it to his brain.
I think they connect. Never mind.
How about this Zimmerman concerned. Case on the Trayvon Martin thing?
Right, and that's the
I
thing I was concerned
I can't believe that the media is allowing Zimmerman's lawyer now to say he was really attacked. The kid was the aggressor. Haven't they listened to the tape and realized the kid was running for his life, running away, trying to get back to his gated community where he was a little protected, and then the guy running after him, pursuing him, which the police said not to do. So of course he defended himself and scrapped and clawed. I haven't heard that side of it yet, and I don't understand the lawyers not making that point that the kid was defending himself. He should be the one that sues under the stand your ground law, this idiot who was pursuing him. How do you do self-defense when you're the one chasing the guy and kill him?
Right,
how
exactly.
is that self-defense?
Right, but you're asking the for-profit 1% media to do things the for-profit 1% media are not capable of doing, Bob.
I just hope that they see through that one, and that there is an arrest and a prosecution
and
we got a grand jury.
You really want that? You really want that kind of incisive question? You really think I understand, but you really think that kind of incisive questioning is going to come from Joe Scarborough?
I'm listening to it from Chris Matthews, who thinks he has to be fair and let this other lawyer have his say without asking the challenging question of, wasn't the kid running for his life, so of course he scraped and clawed against Zimmerman? He never asked the question.
Oh, Chris is afraid somebody's going to call him a liberal.
I mean, if Zimmerman didn't have a little blood on his head and a broken nose, I'd say, what was this kid up to?
Well, hell, he shot him point blank.
That's my
point. He's got his blood on him.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, see, the point that I've been making, and I'm proud to see that others have, because it's much more a point that needs to be made by others than by me, is that there is a very bright line that extends from Emmett Till in 1955 to Trayvon Martin in 2012. There really, really is. And even the stuff that Chris Hayes...
Well, you started out when I thought we were off the air talking about slavery, you know?
Yeah, no. But Chris Hayes had a thing. I guess the FBI's working to recover some audio. Trayvon Martin may have made his own 911 call. Holy cow.
Well, that would be useful.
Yeah, and it would be huge because it would be...
If the police didn't destroy it.
Yeah, so, you know, that's waiting to come. But I tell you what... Every time I look forward to these trips to D.C. and these radio rows, Bob, because I always hope that I have a chance to have a conversation with you.
This was
great.
Because
you are wired up. You know what the hell's going on, and you have the dry passion to scream it from the rooftops. And
I like using the fact that I've had the blessing of having worked on the Hill and in the White House, and then I can bring that into the issues that we all care about in our direction.
How did you get into the Clinton White House? I've never heard that story.
We lost the Congress. And when I was working for John Conyers, we lost the Congress. And the Clinton White House asked me to come in because, remember Clinton's drug policy was I didn't inhale?
Yes.
Well, they didn't think that was really a drug policy. That there was education, prevention, rehabilitation, treatment, as well as law enforcement and foreign policy. There actually was a drug strategy. So he was getting creamed on that issue. So I talked to Mike McCurry, who was Clinton's press secretary, and I talked to Rahm, and they said, we've got to have you here to help us with this and to get the message out that there's actually a drug policy. So I went in as the drug policy spokesman under four-star General Barry McCaffrey.
Okay. Well, that's it. Obviously, from that point to this, you have never slowed down and you have never let up. And I hope you don't.
Well, you remember while I was there, then we expanded a little because I was harassed by Ken Starr. Do you remember that story?
Yes, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
He subpoenaed my wife and me. She saw her friends on TV putting out a press release saying Trips tapes were illegal of Lewinsky. And so we called them up to congratulate them for their press release on TV. And Starr thought it was some White House conspiracy and subpoenaed me as obstructing Clinton's case. So I went out. I let him subpoena me. I went into the courthouse and said, this is Big Brother at its worst. And we made the lead of Brokaw and Jennings. And we were interviewed on Today and Good Morning America with that message, and Starr fell from popularity, and Clinton became the victim. So we've had some fun in the stuff we've done.
Well, and it doesn't surprise me in the least that that would be something that you would do, because
I was very proud of that one. The New York Times said that I would, just to, I mean, if I can just say this humbly, New York Times said I was the first witness in the grand jury case that Starr had that went out in the courthouse steps and challenged him for overreach. The New York Times credited me for that. So I try not to be bashful.
Well, you shouldn't be. You know, I can't hear the name Ken Starr, Bob, without thinking, well, there's $70 million we'll never get back.
Correct. And 7 years, and it's like the Chinese fortune cookie. You had to say about sex to any of those charges that he threw out there.
Right.
Obstruction and whatever else. Your listeners are going to hate me for this. But half the guys in America would have done the same thing. They're not going to go they're not going to go advertising that they had an affair, because half marriages end in divorce.
I said that while it was happening. I mean,
it's actually the honorable thing to do, to not talk about an affair if you have one.
Yes. This is my 16-year-old son, Bob, and we've had that conversation.
Uh-oh.
Gentlemen, do not tell. Kiss and tell.
Yeah. So that's what Ken Starr, with the flaw I give on that one, Reno should not have empowered Starr to go after that sexual piece of the investigation. When Starr came to him and to her and said, can I have the additional power, she should have said no. I do fault Reno for giving him that power.
Well, see, I remember when Carville wrote the book and the horse he rode in on.
You know, I was in that book as a whole chapter, I just described to you.
I know. And but he, you know, he also describes the whole thing whereby, who was it, Centel?
Yes.
That empowered Starr in the first place.
Right.
Yeah, not a comedy, but a tragedy of errors from the beginning. From well-meaning people like Janet Reno, who never should have. Bob Wiener, it is always
a pleasure
to talk to you, my friend, and I look forward to the next time I get to sit down to a conversation.
Great.
Take care.
Sorry I babbled after you wanted to be done earlier.
Oh, no, I didn't want to be done earlier. I was fine. It's always an adventure keeping up with your schedule in one of these things, because it becomes fluid and it runs, you know.
This is great. We want to make sure we get a copy of this.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. All right. Let me have a card, and I'll click this out, and I'll make sure that you get it. All right, take care, Bob. Thanks. Bob Wiener of Robert Wiener Associates, Wiener Public, Wiener Public.com. And you know what that does? That brings us to the, you know, this is where we would queue up High Flight. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and chased the shouting winds along. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've climbed the windswept heights with easy grace where never lark nor even eagle flew. And with silent, lifting mind, I've reached out my hand and touched the face of God.
That's all, folks.
That's what you don't remember when TV stations signed off. You don't even know what that means.
No, I don't.
But that was done, you know, it shows the pilot getting into his fighter bomber aircraft, which you would use to, like, bomb brown people into oblivion. And it's this poem about touching God. But, you know, he's at 50,000 feet, and he's reaching out his hand and touching the face of God. Do you know what would happen if he reached out his hand and touched the face of God?
He'd been ripped off and frozen.
It'd land in the Sea of Marmara. That's the kind of silliness you do. No, but it is. It's time to quit. It's time to start packing up. Packing up and loading out is going to be a booger, because we can't get anywhere near here.
They've got the Capitol blocked off.
Yeah, I know. We have to go out and reconnoiter which way we have to hike. We are parked a million miles away at Union Station.
I knew the way to get around it.
You've been doing your work. The voice you're hearing now is, of course, Ferg.
Hello, folks.
Who deserves no voices.
No
voices, thank you.
All right. Yes, Miss Daisy.
No, stop it. Who, as reward and recompense for his hard work in this broadcast day, gets to say a couple of words, which he just did in saying, "That's all, folks."
Thank you.
So with that being the case, and it being 4 minutes or so, 3 minutes or so, until 3 p.m., that gets us pretty close to three solid hours of broadcasting, minus a few profound gaps that Agnes might kindly remove from the record. I will say that I hope you enjoyed the conversations we had here at Radio Row. I want to extend a special thanks to our hosts here in the United Methodist Building, the United Methodists, and extend thanks particularly to our dear friends at Families USA who do understand the value of progressive messaging and walk the walk and talk the talk. There is a lot of hard work that goes into all this. Folks like Dave Lemon and my buddy Arian and Candy Stroud, who pulls the Radio Row together. Thanks to all of them. And thanks to you for joining in and listening. I hope you have gotten value out of this. I hope maybe some of these things about the Affordable Care Act have been cleared up, and that you understand that it's not all, you know, that it's not all bad.
There's hope.
There's a lot of it that's good. A great deal of it that is good. So with that, we will sign off and thank you. And the next time you hear our voices will probably be, as far as live broadcast, either Thursday night or Friday night, depending on when we arrive back in the studio at the mansion in West Virginia.
Charlie Bucket Mansion.
Shut up. It is not our Charlie Bucket house. Stop that. That's your home.
I love my home.
I know.
I just don't love the environment.
I don't like it when it rains in the bedroom on your mother either, but it is what it is. Now, the next time you hear from us, it'll probably be either Thursday night or Friday night, because we're going to do a little bit more work with the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign while we are here, that maximizing two birds, stones, something about rocks. So I'll thank you all very kindly, wish you well, and look forward to talking to you when we talk to you, which will probably be Thursday or Friday. Until then, take care, and thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen, from you who kindly contribute to keep the program on the air, to your contribution of your thoughts, your ideas, your emails, your phone calls. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You know, you can go to crmw.net. You can order the coolest T-shirt in America, the Save the Endangered Hillbilly T-shirt. You can sign up for the email newsletter, and you can even give a contribution. You can be part, therefore, of the struggle for basic human rights in Appalachia. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch, and I've been doing my own bit of advocacy here to try to make folks aware of the human rights crisis, the Appalachian apocalypse. I never go anywhere that I don't do a little bit of missionary work. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk soon. Bye now.
Bye.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Yeah, okay, for those of you wondering, yes, the Horn website has been hacked again. Little bastards. They're like little Ferengis. Like to transport a boatload of tribbles under there. Ben Birch is on his way home from work, and will hopefully get it sorted out in the fairly immediate future. It would appear that the stream is safe, and we are going out.
WhiteRoseSociety.org is also safe. It's pretty clear that what these rotten little bastards are after is HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. You know, it's funny how that happens. I told off a right-wing POS earlier today, and then bang, we're hacked again. Last night, Sandra and a few others of us were having some fun giggling about the super secret, double secret probation, oh my God, hug tape that the now mercifully dead Andrew Breitbart had been promising was out there. He just didn't get around. He didn't live long enough to dummy it up and maybe Photoshop some hammers and sickles onto Barack Obama's shirt pocket and stuff. But no, it shows that he was friends with Professor Bell, the Jeremiah Wright of academia. That's really what they're calling the guy. And the next thing you know, the Horn website gets hacked. Isn't it funny how that works? Yeah, I thought so. No, I'm not laughing either. But anyway, that's where we are.